welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 235. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz. With me today, Evan Birchfield.
Hey, everybody.
Evan, the co-founder of this podcast.
Yeah, I don't like to claim that, though, because you guys have done so much with it since I've been gone. It's like Radio Free Nintendo lives on its own.
I think the last time Evan's voice was heard on the show might have been like episode 150.
Yeah. No, we did a special time.
It's been almost 2 years.
Yeah, I think that was about the last time I played a video game, too.
Well, okay, we've corrected that, so don't worry. And of course, Greg Leahy is back this week.
Ahoy, ahoy, everyone.
Happy St. Patrick's Day, Greg Leahy.
It stopped being St. Patrick's Day about 50 minutes ago.
Fair enough.
But I appreciate the sentiment.
Sure. You're welcome. John Lindemann is on the line.
That's actually, let me just correct you, that's the bronze medal winning John Lindemann. So
yeah. we'll get to that later. And James Jones.
Hey.
It's so good to see you guys again. So we were just, three of us out of the five were just at PAX East last week, and we had such a great time. I hope everyone's listened to the panel. If you haven't, why are you skipping episodes? What's wrong with you?
God damn you.
Go listen to the show. And we live streamed it, and Greg, did you hear the whole thing live?
There were some snafus of various sorts, but yeah. I did manage to see and hear pretty much all of it.
Despite that, that's like a Chariots of Fire sort of bullshit that you actually listened to it across the pond the entire time. I'm impressed.
I don't get that reference, but yeah.
Yeah, it's called the internet. Things have evolved a bit since you left.
Yeah. At one point, I mean, there was this amazing moment during the panel when Carly says, "Hey, we have a question from Greg." I was like, "Greg Leahy? Awesome."
That's excellent.
Yeah. We had such a good time at PAX. And of course, we really wish Greg was there. I wish Evan was there too. But we had such a good time. We're going to talk about some of the games we played. But I do want to start out by thanking everybody who showed up, everyone who was able to attend physically, who talked to us, you know, during and after the show. We really had a great time. We had about double the attendance from last year. And we got to try a lot of new things, including the radio trivia, which I was very excited about. And I know there were some problems with the organization of it. It was a little bit chaotic at times, which really didn't surprise me, but we just didn't have time ahead of time to figure out exactly how we wanted to run that part of it. But I did think it was very engaging for the audience. I think it sort of captured people's imagination and people's attention, and it was really fun to do. And, you know, I wanted to get TYP involved in the show as well, so it was a good way to do that. So I was very happy with how it went. And you know, we know some people who weren't there have listened to the audio and said, wow, that part was kind of confusing. It was mixed weirdly. I think it made a little more sense if you were there physically. So part of it is that the mixing levels were a little more normalized in the audio recording. But yeah, I mean, we're going to clean up some of that. We want to do it again for sure. And I we'll improve it. But I thought it was a very successful experiment. So thanks for putting up with us.
And to give a shout out to TYP, I haven't seen that man in like, what, 5 years?
5 or 6 years.
E3 2006 was the last time I got to see these people since the last time I saw Lindy as well. That seemed pretty incredible. It's great to be next to the man himself, Jonathan Metz, here. And
yeah.
One day I'll join you guys at PAX East. It's going to be excellent.
Yeah. So one thing I did want to say before we get going is that if you enjoyed the panel, either in person or over the feed, and you'd like to let PAX know that you enjoyed it and that you'd like to have us back, you can actually send an email to PAX_panel@paxsite.com. PAXSITE.com. And that is a public email address. It's in the guide. I mean, it's in the program that they hand out at PAX. And they do encourage fans to write in and sort of give feedback. So if you do like the program, I think that would help us and it would help them to sort of gauge interest in that sort of thing.
Right.
I do believe we were the only Nintendo-centric podcast at PAX East this year. Mm-hmm. So I think we've sort of developed a niche, and I feel pretty confident that we'll be able to do it next year. But, you know, if you send them an email and sort of say nice things about it, it couldn't hurt. So.
Can I send them an email and ask them why you pronounce the word niche?
Niche?
It's niche.
Shut it, Leipzig. You've got nothing to stand on. That will be enough of your pedantry
it's
for this foyer, episode.
It's foyer, not foyer, people. Please.
Oh, yeah, no.
It's French.
I agree.
It's called French.
Foyer.
It's poutine, not poutine.
Would it be bad form for me to send an email to this website as I enjoyed the panel? I thought it went very well.
I think it's proper form.
Yeah, for conflict you. Of interest, but I don't think that's ever stopped us
before.
Well,
you weren't really on the panel, Greg, so I think you could send an email.
Yeah. Let's read your fan letter on the podcast while you're on it. I think that would be pretty incredible.
From the horse's mouth. Well, although, there is something I'm afraid I can't let slide. Now, I don't wish to be disobedient.
Mistakes were made, I'm sure. It's live.
Well, yeah, but this one, I could... Early on in the proceedings, the issue of the next Zelda getting delayed to the next console came up.
Really?
At which point, there was a, we don't want another Twilight Princess. And then Johnny said, I like Twilight Princess fine when I played it the first time when it was called Ocarina of Time.
This
is not an especially original gag at the best of times, but I'm afraid coming from Johnny is untenable. As not only did this man give said Twilight Princess a 10 in his 2006 review for Nintendo World Report, but the intro reads thusly. It, Twilight Princess, is nearly as daring as Eiji Inuma's first game as Zelda director Majora's Mask, which walked the fine line between feeling like a true Zelda game and yet upended nearly every convention of the series.
Wow, I wish I could rewrite that review.
It's not quite consistent with
Look,
your thoughts.
I was under a lot of pressure. I had to get that review out before the Wii launch date. I had to play that entire game in a week.
See, the funny thing about you trying to get that review out before the Wii launch date is that most people were trying to just buy the game before the Wii launch date, like buy the Wii launch date.
Yeah.
I remember having to go to two or three different stores back then. What was that, 5 years ago? Just to buy that game. So here you are. I don't know if I necessarily need to hear you complaining about spending days on a puzzle in Twilight Princess 5 days before it came out for the rest of us plebeians.
Yeah, I had to fend off GameStop trying to sell me a used new copy. Oh yeah, we've opened this one, but we're gonna sell it to you for full price. No thanks.
What?
Oh yes,
that's right. Because John likes to have his game sealed.
I like it. Well, if I'm paying full price, absolutely,
perpetually, yes, indefinitely. So I thought for new business, of course, I want to hear what Greg's been playing because he had a week off last weekend, a very rare, much deserved. Weekend off, and so I know he's been playing a lot, and we've played games at home, but I thought maybe we could kick off by talking about some of the games we played at PAX East, because we didn't really get a chance to talk about that. We did the panel fairly early in the convention, and then the only other podcast we recorded was, I think it's probably going to end up being posted as a rough draft over at Crosstalk, because it was much more about It was much more about beer than it was about Nintendo. I think the video game discussion was really incidental to the drunk tales and beer snobbery that was going on there.
Something that you discover when you turn 21 is that video games and beer go together a lot better than you thought they would.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, if you wait till you turn 21, that's not necessarily a rule.
So we're not really on record yet talking about some of the games that we played at PAX, and I think there are a number of things that are worth discussing that are very much including, of course, you know, the Omegathon always ends with a surprise game. That's the sort of tournament that they do at PAX. There's a huge prize for the people who are selected to participate. And most of the rounds are announced ahead of time, and they had some really fun stuff this year, like Jenga and Operation. I love the idea of like competitive Operation in front of a group, which sounds like the most stressful thing I've ever heard of.
Shit, yes.
But the final round is always a surprise, and it was unveiled. We all attended, those of us who were still there. James missed it, unfortunately. But those of us who were still there went and attended that, and it was revealed to be Ikaruga. And of course, I immediately thought of Greg Leahy, because Greg loves treasure games. Greg, what do you think of the idea of Ikaruga being, I mean, do you think that's a good choice?
It'd be interesting to see how people react to that as a surprise. I mean, Ikaruga is one of these things that you have to prepare for mentally.
Yeah, I don't think it was as good for the public to watch it, though. I don't think it was as interesting in practice.
What version were they playing?
GameCube.
Oh.
Well, it's funny because they teased it. They threw out a couple of clues, and afterwards I was like, how did they not say, how did they not make a joke about frothing demand?
Yeah.
I mean, it was so ripe for that. But they actually mentioned that it's one of the most visually rich games for the Dreamcast, and yet they ended up playing the GameCube version because I think it is sort of the definitive best version. And we were sort of lamenting the fact that, you know, they pull out this really hardcore shoot 'em up game for the final Omegathon round, and they didn't play it in Tate mode, which would be the most hardcore way to play it.
Why don't you explain to people what that mode is?
Tate mode is basically a way to replicate the way that the game was originally presented in the arcades, which was with a vertical monitor, so that it was kind of a widescreen monitor, but turned 90 degrees so that it was taller than it was wide, because it's a vertical shoot 'em up. So basically gave you more of field to view the action. And so when they brought it to home consoles, most TVs, of course, are wider than they are tall. And so there's always letterboxes, and the size of the letterbox depends on whether your screen is 4x3 or 16x9 or whatever. But the console versions on GameCube, maybe Dreamcast, and definitely on Xbox Live Arcade, they support this feature called Tate mode, which means sort of, I think it's Japanese for standing or like on its side. And so Tate mode, it basically turns the display 90 degrees, expecting you to then turn your television 90 degrees so that you can play it in its original aspect ratio, which is very much vertical. And, you know, with a lot of TVs, especially like plasma TVs, it's kind of recommended that you don't do that because it's sort of bad for the TV. But we went back, and as we're watching them play this during the Omegathon, we were all turned to each other like, we really want to play Ikaruga after this. I mean, it made us want to play it for the first time in years. So we went back to John's apartment that night, and we played Ikaruga, and John has this LCD monitor that he plays video games on.
Widescreen.
Yeah, more widescreen. It's beautiful, John. It's really nice. And Mike Sklins was there, Striker Obi, and he's like, oh, you have a Dell monitor. Don't those usually come with these mounting stands that allow you to rotate the screen? And so after a few minutes of trying to figure out how to make this work, we did successfully rotate the screen vertically, and so we played Ikaruga in Tate mode.
Yeah, I mean, it worked perfectly.
It did. It was beautiful. I thought it was a really delicious way to end the PAX East experience.
Yeah.
You know, going home and playing the final round of Omegathon at home in the way that it's kind of meant to be played.
Well, the reason they didn't play it like that is because they had to project it, and they would have had to have projectors that projected sideways.
Fair. Yeah, that's a good, very good point. So some of the other games we played, I guess we should talk about 3DS. I mean, we did get to play some 3DS demos on the floor.
They were the same demos from the Nintendo press events.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. I mean, we've written about them, not we, but other people on the staff have written impressions of these same demos.
Except for LEGO Star Wars 3D, which nobody refuses to write about.
Well, I think I'm the only one on the show that hasn't played 3DS, right? I mean, right. Outside of Evan.
Well, before.
Yeah, I hadn't played it before PAX.
Before he shit his pants, yes.
Well, it was good. I mean, it was pretty much like it didn't blow me away, but it was just like, yeah, this is 3D. The screen has depth. Like, it wasn't jarring. It really works well.
Yeah, I think part of that's because you've had 9 months from initial impressions to sort of digest.
But still, I'd never seen it, though. And everybody says that the big thing is, oh, once you see it, it's going to be amazing. It's going to change your life. But, I mean, I was just like, yeah, it's cool. I mean, it's in 3D and things have depth. But, like, I don't think that a lot of the games really actually used the 3D. You know, the only game that really used it to me was Face Raiders.
Right.
I agree.
But it's a tech demo, which is why.
But it is a very effective tech demo.
Yeah, well, it's still a tech demo.
Yeah, like a lot of the games, I felt they just played like GameCube games or something like that, except they just happened to have a 3D effect overlaid over them.
It's weird, but the one game that I actually thought looked decent in 3D, which was the only one that I hadn't seen before in some form, was Dead or Alive, actually.
Yeah, Dead or Alive is actually a really, really beautiful game.
That game is shockingly not terrible.
Yeah. It's actually really good.
And possibly, like, a desirable piece of software.
Mm-hmm.
That game actually did do some stuff with the 3D in the fighter models, so that actually looked decent.
Yeah, I would say that's the one that I was probably the most impressed with. I mean, I knew that Street Fighter 4 would look really good, and since they were using the empty framework engine,
right.
Like, I knew that would be very, very impressive. But Dead or Alive definitely was the one that probably impressed me the most. I also enjoyed which was a surprise to me, Steel Diver. I thought that was really good.
Steel Diver?
Which I think is just a hilarious name. It still makes me laugh every time I hear it. It's just, it's strangely pornographic to me for some reason.
Well, unfortunately, the part of Steel Diver in the demo was only the periscope mode.
No, it wasn't.
Well, that's the only part I saw.
The whole game's there.
Really?
Yeah, you could play the normal Steel Diver mode, swimming in a terrarium, which is boring.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. It looks boring.
And then you could do the periscope mode. I believe you probably could have done the strategy mode, but it's not unlocked because you have to beat the game to do it.
Oh. Yeah.
Now, for the periscope mode, I thought it was kind of silly that you had the option of turning the periscope by moving your entire handheld. I thought that was kind of silly.
You have to play in a wheelie chair, basically, a swivel chair.
Yeah, I thought that was kind of silly.
Or you get tangled up in the tether cable.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, when you own the game on your own 3DS, there is no tether cable. So that,
well, obviously, but in the demo, that did happen, and I watched it happen to people.
And you ended up coiling it around the poor lady that was tethered to it.
Yeah. I actually choked somebody right out. It was kind of a scene, but... Yeah, I mean, I just thought it kind of smacked of, hey, we're doing this just because we can and we just want to show off.
Well, and to be clear, you can actually use the touchscreen to do that instead, but I actually found the touchscreen controls for rotating during that part were not very responsive. I don't know if I was and also there's a lever on the touchscreen that lets you raise and lower your elevation in the water, and I found that also had this kind of weird lag to it, which, you know, it's probably an old demo, so that could be part of it. But yeah, I found it just the touch controls for that part of the game I found to be kind of weirdly not very responsive.
Well, I think some of it is they're actually trying to model a response you would get in a submarine.
Okay.
There's a certain amount of hydrodynamics that come into play with submarines.
I'll buy that, but it felt weird. I did play some of Zelda 3D for the first time. I mean, I'd seen it when I saw it at E3 last year. It was just a video, so this was the first time I'd played it, and I had a good time playing it. You know, I thought it felt good with the control stick, you know, with the joystick, and I think that's one of the reasons that they couldn't have done this on DS. You know, it's not that the engine wouldn't have run on DS, but I think control-wise, it would have been kind of a problem with the D-pad. And so with the joystick, it works well. It feels right. It does look good. I think that game's looking better every time we see it. But I did get into the Deku Tree, which I'd forgotten how much the Deku Tree talks before you get into it. He gives you this really long speech, this lecture about how...
the fucking tree die.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, he's going to die anyway, so... Yeah, but I mean, I finally got into the tree and I started the dungeon. And the funny thing I found was that, you know, we've talked about before how the graphics are sort of inconsistent in this remake because they're polishing up certain things and other things that are sort of leaving the same as they were before, it seems. And a lot of the textures still look very kind of blurry N64, but then you go to those walls that have the vines on them that you can climb, and the vine texture is really high res. I mean, it looks completely different than even my memory of it is. It looks way, 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 way better. But the weird thing is it looks better than everything else in the game.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the graphics are very inconsistent in that remake, and I wonder if all that's going to be brought together and become more unified closer to launch, or if it's, you know, I wonder if they're starting to lock it in at this point.
Well, it's confirmed for June, at least in one region, isn't it? So there isn't very much more time.
Right.
One thing that disappoints me about that, from what I've seen of it, is the fact that they haven't improved the instrument quality of the music at all. You know, it just sounds exactly the same as it did before, which the soundtrack to Ocarina of Time is wonderful, but there are some cases where the synthesized instruments really are not quite fit for purpose, especially the trumpets. So 3DS is packing a much, much more robust sound capabilities than the sound processor-less N64.
Right. Yeah, I couldn't really pick that up on the show floor, you know, with a demo, but... That doesn't really surprise me, you know, and I think we've talked about this a lot before, but the fact that it still looks like an N64 game, I think in the process of remaking it, they are upgrading it to an extent, but they don't want it to look like a GameCube game. They don't want it to look like a Wii game. They want it to look like an N64 game in the most idealized version of your memories, you know, because they want it to be nostalgic. So when you play it, and, you know, and I thought this from looking at screenshots and movies, but now that I've actually played the newest demo of it, I really do feel like it looks like an N64 game on steroids. which makes it look a little more like a Dreamcast game, except without that sort of bubblegum sort of color palette that a lot of Dreamcast games have. But it does have a smoother look to it. It's more high res, but it's still very inconsistent.
Can you comment at all on how the, like, have they changed anything with, like, the enemy dynamics in this game? Because
not that
certainly
I've seen.
They did that with Resident Evil 4, where since you had different controls and it's not
in the Wii version, you mean
the Wii version, yeah, of Resident Evil 4. Yeah, they made it a lot more difficult because you had a greater aiming capability. But it sounds like they've kept the same template, upgrading graphics.
Yeah,
and that's about it.
Yeah, I don't think they're really going to change the enemy placement or the level of difficulty and the design. I mean, we now know that the Master Quest is included, which is a little bit harder.
Yeah, well, that's nice.
Yeah, than the original. So you can do that.
There's been some non-specific comments that it's going to have, like, surprises. There will be certain things in it that you're not expecting.
Like, you can find the Triforce? Like, that would be...
No.
Ocarina's a broken game, if only because you cannot get the Triforce by the end.
You have it. Link has the Triforce of Courage.
Oh, he has... Well, he has... That's one force. That's a one force. That's not the same as a Triforce.
He was born with
that's
it.
That's a Uniforce.
That's...
We're just making up lore now.
Yeah. No, it's in his hand.
Triforce is old news. It's all about the Uniforce. Get with the program.
Okay, so we did play some 3DS. For my money, you know, it's been like 9 months since I played 3DS. And I was expecting to be sort of wowed by the 3D effect the way I was the first time. And I actually, surprisingly, I was kind of in the same shoes as John when I saw it, which is, oh, okay, it's in 3D. Like, it really didn't hit me with the same force that it did the first time. So, you know, we've heard from the guys in Japan talking about the systems that they own now, about how the 3D really doesn't seem to be a really drastic feature. Like, that's not really the main reason to own it. And I would agree, from playing it again, I was surprised. I thought it would kind of mess with my mind a little bit the way it did the first time I played it, and that really didn't happen. I was focused on how do I control this, how much depth does the game seem to have. I was more focused on the mechanics of the games and the graphical quality, and the 3D effect, it just sort of clicked very quickly, and then I wasn't paying that much attention to it anymore. Okay, so let's move on to a few other games we played. John, you referenced a certain tournament earlier.
And this was in the retro, the classic console gaming room, which was one of our kind of haunts over the course of the show.
Yeah, yeah.
Let me just say before we start that you were abandoned by your comrades.
Oh, what, during the tournament?
Yes.
Yeah, that is true. That is true. But it's okay, you know, not everybody wants to watch a good friend of theirs succeed at a lifelong dream.
Not all of them. I stayed.
Yeah, you stayed. You stayed, and I commend you. I commend you for that.
Okay, the way I put it to John is, look,
I don't give a shit about your hockey. Yes, that's what you said.
No, it was like, look, if you want to play in a Sega CD tournament, I understand, because how many times in your life do you get the opportunity to play in a Sega CD tournament?
Tournament level Sewer Shark every year.
Yeah. But I don't necessarily want to watch you do that, especially when it's NHL 94.
Yeah. So that was the tournament
and
the game in question.
So James stuck around to just kick you when you lost, I assume?
Yeah.
I cheered for John, thank you very much.
Sure you did, just to make the heart break.
Well,
all that
to be,
more
to be,
painful.
To be fair, Carly was there, so I couldn't be too derisive.
Yeah, yeah.
Or I would have been stabbed when I was sleeping.
I will say that James did make fun of me quite a bit when I was actually losing in the final game.
Oh, that's sad.
I did not.
It was kind of harsh, dude. You were getting your digs in there. You were getting your digs in there.
I just said that you were the hockey equivalent of Gary Bettman,
yeah.
which is two levels of jokes that only John will get here.
I get it. I get it. But yeah, so yes, the game was NHL 94, which is a game that is near and dear to my heart. I used to play it a ton back in high school.
Where are you at, Insano Lord?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I missed Insano Lord at this year's show. You know, I would have liked to have challenged him again. But, you know, in lieu of him being there, I was forced to take the bronze medal in the NHL 94 tournament. So, you know, I think I beat two people in a row, and then the last dude, he beat me like 3-2. I'm not going to get too inside hockey with it, but generally with that particular game, if somebody chooses Pittsburgh, choose like Pittsburgh, Chicago, or Detroit. That's my pro tip for everybody out there. Don't choose Montreal because they don't have the offensive firepower. But anyways, yeah. So
if you happen to be playing NHL 94 on Sega CD,
you know,
here's a pro tip.
To be fair, though, it's the exact same game as on Sega Genesis.
Yeah, see, that's the funny thing, though, and it was because this was on the CD version of the game, and so I was like, cool, you know, when I first got it, because I had rented it earlier on in the show, and I was like, cool, you know, maybe there's going to be something new, because I mean, I've played the console, you know, one to death.
Guess what? It's the same fucking game.
Pretty much what like our takeaway from the show is that pretty much it just the CD ones of any of those games, it just basically made the game worse by adding, you know, you had like better like soundtracks, but yeah, I mean, generally all it did was just add crappy load time and crappy movies, which are horribly pixelated.
I mean, what music do you need for hockey?
And I couldn't even really hear it, but I mean, really, honestly, like for this game, I'm assuming that because we didn't have the sound turned up, so we couldn't really hear it. But
there
I'm assuming
there was an announcer, right?
Yeah, I think they did have Ron Barr like going over welcome to Boston Garden, blah blah blah, which is completely useless, and you just skip it in the game anyways because you never want to hear it. And then also the other game we played on it was Making the Video Crisscross.
No!
Which was...
That classic.
So yeah. John and I made art.
Yeah. Yeah, and that was an interesting game. You know, I'd heard a lot about it.
Did they have the Marky Mark one to choose
from? No, they only had the Crisscross one. And actually, James was the one that pointed it out to me that it was even on the list because it was on one of the back pages and I hadn't looked that far. And he's like, oh, yeah, they have that Crisscross game. I'm like, oh, we're getting that. So... Yeah, I mean, it's not even a game. It's more of like...
It's not. It's a horror show.
Yeah, you can name it a lot of things. It's definitely not a game.
Well, see, I do think we figured out the objective right about the time we got kicked off the system.
Yeah.
Which is if we had paid attention to the terribly stereotypical asshole who introduces every level, we might have understood what we're supposed to do.
Yeah, they have... Well, the thing is, I mean, it's the way it works is it's a video editing app. Really, is what it comes down to.
Do you really want to use that phrase?
It's
it's a video destroying app.
Yeah, so you have there's three crisscross videos on it. There's Jump, I Missed the Bus, and Warm It Up Chris, right? So those are the three big crisscross singles,
you mean,
right?
Wow, Chris.
Yeah.
Wow, Chris.
Wow, Chris.
I'm about to.
So yeah, that's definitely an in joke that nobody will get, but. But yeah, so those are the three songs on there, and the whole idea is that you take one of those songs and it takes you to a screen where you have three different feeds. You have the video feed of the actual video playing on one screen, and then on the two other screens, they just have like these kind of random sort of public domain strange like clips from, you know, old films and monster, you know, films and stuff like that.
Ed Wood styled stock footage.
Oh, yes,
that's exactly
literally.
What it is. It's like video of like rockets taking off in black and white and like right. Old 1940s monster movies. It's just awful.
Yeah.
No, it is Ed Wood, totally.
Yep. Yep. And so you have a main screen where it shows you kind of like what you're making. And so whatever you do to it, like you can like splice in the different video feeds and you can add effects to it. Like you can pixelate it.
Is that possible?
Yeah.
There's actually two different effects to pixelate it further than it's already pixelated.
Yeah.
Which when you layer them on top of each other, it becomes a Rorschach test.
Yep. And I mean, you can split it. You can add strobe effects. You can do all kinds of horrible effects. I mean, effectively, all you do is just make your stuff look like shit. You make your video look absolutely horrible.
So if you turn on all the effects, it's just this blob and you're just thinking, wow.
Yeah, but if you want, you can see the song, you know, lyrics go by, but the video is absolutely destroyed.
That's useful.
Yeah, and while this is all going on, it all records this, and then when you're done, you play it back, and apparently you're scored on your efforts. I have no idea how the scoring works, but it's... Yeah, but the interesting thing that James ran into, that we ran into right off the bat is that, so you create this 2-minute, 3-minute long video, and then it plays it back to you so you can watch your entire horrific creation. And you can't, as far as we could tell, you can't actually exit out of it.
You have to watch the whole video.
Yep. And then it scores you, and I have no idea how the scoring works.
The DJ comes back and says, aw, nah, dude, nah, that's not right.
Yeah.
You screwed this up. What you doing, man? What you
with
whack
that guy
about?
Is that, I mean, he looks like
he looks like DJ Jazzy Jeff.
Where he's like all wearing like all like neon, like a hat to the back and like polka dots and stuff. And oh man, it's terrible.
By the way, Nate Dogg, RIP.
Yes, absolutely. Rest in peace, Nate Dogg. May you regulate in heaven, buddy.
There is video evidence of John playing Criss Cross Make My Video.
I can't wait to see that.
With director commentary.
Yeah.
Hey, James, what was your game of choice in the retro console room?
So I did the NES Rare Compendium. All the old
Battletoads.
I did see some of this. Yeah.
Oh, we played Battletoads versus Double Dragon on the SNES, which is actually a lot easier than the other Battletoads games if it weren't for the fact that we had friendly damage on, and Carly and I beat the crap out of each other more than anything.
Mm-hmm.
We did the Snakes game?
The Snake Rattle and Roll.
Snake Rattle and
Roll.
I
love that game. Yeah, it's awesome.
I can't remember what the other game we played.
No, you played Anticipation, right?
Oh, fuck Anticipation.
What about the Rare version of Pinbot, the pinball table?
I love Pinbot. Oh, I'm a big fan of Pinbot.
So, yeah, Anticipation. Let's talk about that. It's an NES game, and Neil suggested, oh, yeah, that game's awful. You guys should play that. So about four of us, because it's an NES game, there's only two controllers, are playing this game where you have to buzz in while the game draws a picture, and you have some kind of category for what it is. NES quality picture, by the way. And then you have to type in with the down keyboard on the bottom what the hell it's drawing. And it's like Trivial Pursuit in that if you get all the colors, you get to go up to the next level. But it's so bad that we were getting things like words that just didn't make any sense for the answer. And if you got it wrong, it just didn't tell you. It just didn't tell you what the answer was. And then the question would come up again and we'd all be mad at it. But that went on for about half an hour until we got cut off the system and were very thankful that experience ended. The other game that really earned its reputation, so it's actually in the retro arcade room, was Mr. Do's Wild Ride, which is a Donkey Kong-like game in which you play a clown named Mr. Do, who is trying to climb to the top of a roller coaster while the cars are still coming and has to climb up ladders to avoid them as they pound into his face.
Right.
When they hit him, and they will hit him because this game is almost impossible, he gets launched around the screen like he's a ricocheting bullet. I believe it took something like 5 or 6 tries for one of us to beat the stupid thing. What, the first level? The very first freaking level. And then level 2 was just the onslaught of destruction. That game was actually markedly enjoyable simply because not only was it comedically difficult, but then you bouncing around the screen after you've been plowed into by a roller coaster cart was just amusing. That led to us checking out a game called Mr. Do in the retro console room, thinking, oh, well, apparently they ported this game to consoles. That's awesome. No, the game we played was a Dig Dug clone. So I thought it looked like an Intellivision game.
It's for NES, right?
No, that was a Super Nintendo game.
Whoa, that looks like Intellivision?
It looks like an Intellivision game. Ooh. It looked awful. But it was a Super Nintendo game where basically your objective is to dig around and collect cherries that are buried underground. And then if you dig the ground out from under these, I don't know, were they pumpkins or whatever? I couldn't tell because the graphics were terrible. You would be crushed by them if you were under them. So it did star the intrepid Mr. Do, but it was not the same game.
Hmm.
But I felt like I learned a lot from my experience with Do and his various adventures.
Well, that's what you do at PAX. You learn.
You do learn, and I learned that I hate Mr. Do, and that I love Mr. Do's Wild Ride.
So what I learned is, first off, Crystalis is still awesome.
Well, no shit.
It's been a long time since I played the original NES Crystalis, because James and I have both played the Game Boy Color one that's not, it's not a good port. Really.
It's still a good game, but it's not a good port.
Right. Like, you can tell, oh, this was really good before Nintendo Software Technologies fucked it up hardcore.
Like I said, it's still playable. It's just...
Oh, yeah.
It's just like enemies are off-screen raping you because you can't fucking see them.
Yeah. The GBC has, like, a square screen, so the aspect ratio is really messed up.
And Nintendo made no effort to fix this problem.
Yeah. It's really sad, because if you go back and play the NES version, which they had at PAX East, it's still awesome. And it brought back so many good memories, and it makes me want to play that game again so much. I was playing it on the system. It's funny, the first day we went to the retro console room, they had all these NESs, and they were having all kinds of problems, and you put in a game, and it didn't work, and they called over a tech. They had an NES tech. And I think that's pretty much all he was doing, was fixing the NESs, because they were so problematic. And he'd come over, and he'd clean it with a Q-tip and rubbing alcohol, and he'd arrange the... you know, the slot in a very weird way.
Yes.
I actually ended up playing Crystalis for 30 minutes with the cartridge in the up position.
Yes, that's how we played Snake Rattle and Roll.
I didn't know that was possible. I don't know how he arranged that to make that work.
That's intense.
But yeah, so he did all kinds of crazy stuff. And the funny thing was they had signs everywhere saying don't blow into the cartridges.
Yes.
Which is kind of funny. But yeah, I mean,
which is the established best method.
No, it's bad though. I mean, it moisturizes the contacts and they rust.
It's bad according to the powers that be.
It's bad according to people who still have any working NES games.
Independent thought alarm.
That's right. These are people who own these systems. It's fine. Let them do what they want to do.
They know what's good and what's bad for these games. So I respect their rules very much. Chrysalis is still really good. And it's like, why the hell isn't this game on Virtual Console? Because it's so awesome. It is, if you've never played Chrysalis, I really recommend tracking down a copy for NES. The Game Boy Color version is like an acceptable substitute, but it's definitely not the ideal way to play that game. On the NES, it's really magnificent. It's basically a Zelda clone, Zelda 1, and it's in a lot of ways better, more sophisticated. I mean, it came out years later. It's more colorful. It plays a little bit faster. It has scrolling. So it just feels like kind of almost a whole generation removed from the original Legend of Zelda. But the framework of the game is very similar, and I think it's just as good. I mean, it's really excellent game. And I only got to play it for 30 minutes at PAX East, but I relished the experience, and it made me want to go grab a copy. I also played an old NES game called Zexus because I saw it on the list, and I was like, wow, I haven't played Zexus in 20 years, so I really want to play this. And it was a game that I liked a lot when I was a kid. I used to play it at Boys and Girls Club because we had an NES and we played games there. And it's a Sunsoft game. And it's funny because I remembered liking Zexus in a very vague way. You know, I knew that I liked it as a kid, but I didn't really remember why. And I didn't remember much about the details of what the game plays like or what it looks like. It just, I knew it had some shooting to it, basically, that's about as far as it went. I popped this game in and I played it, and immediately I feel like, oh, now I know why I liked this game when I was a kid, because it's like the games I like now. It's actually, it's a Hudson game, so it has some similarities to Mylan's Secret Castle, but also some similarities to Metroid and even Zelda 2. So it's a 2D action side scroller where you shoot and your gun has sort of a limited range, but then later on you can upgrade it and it becomes more powerful and the shots move in a different pattern. You can jump around a lot. You go through doorways and talk to people who give you hints or they sell you things. So you're collecting money to buy upgrades and life ups and things like that. And it's sort of very non-linear. So you kind of scroll back and forth trying to find the sort of the secret way out. You have to hit certain blocks multiple times to make hidden doors appear, which is very Mylan's Secret Castle. But there are characters who tell you in readable English this time what you need to do to proceed. And so you do a few things and you move on to the next area. And then you jump into a robot suit and it turns into a 2D horizontal shoot 'em up, which is very competent for an NES shoot 'em up. It's actually quite good. And so then you play, and even in the shoot 'em up part, there are branching paths, and you sort of choose whether to go up or down through the different doors, and they take you into different corridors. It's a very interesting game, actually. I mean, it's sort of a late NES game. It's like 89, 90, depending on which region you're talking about. Very interesting, and again, it's like, this is a Hudson game. Why isn't this out on Virtual Console? Seriously. Every other Hudson game is out. This is a really interesting game. I'd love to play more of it. Why isn't it out there? This is not an easy game to get a hold of. It's really sad. And actually, when I checked it out at the Retro Console Room, they told me I was the first person all weekend who had checked it out. Just so sad.
Wow, it's, really?
Apparently, it's even more obscure than I thought. If you want to look up Zexus, it's spelled Xexyz.
Which is in no way, shape, or form how that should be spelled.
Yeah, right. I know that game from its ads in EGM. It had some full page ads, and I remember it just because, number one, of the weird name, and also the ad had this like big silver robot on it.
Well, that's not completely removed from the game itself. There is a robot suit that you jump into that costs money to jump into, even though it's required that you do it to proceed. But once you do, that's when it becomes a shoot 'em up. It's a very interesting game. I mean, it has elements of, like I said, Zelda 2, Fazanadu, but also Metroid. You can shoot up and horizontally. The jumping feels very similar to Metroid. It's a very, very cool game. So I enjoyed my time with that. And finally, to wrap up the PAX games that we played, we got some time, thanks to Neil Ronahan, we got some time with the Rock Band 3 Fender Squire guitar controller. Mm. And John, I know you played some of this as well.
Yep.
I thought it was a fascinating experience, and it is a very expensive controller. I mean, this is the real guitar, basically. It's a MIDI guitar that you can connect to the game, but you can also plug it into an amplifier or whatever. And I barely play guitar. I mean, I shouldn't even say that. I own a guitar that I really don't know what to do with. So it was almost a completely fresh experience for me. And I did find there's a very steep learning curve on it. I mean, it's difficult to play in the game. We're playing on easy. We're playing like the easiest songs on the easiest difficulty level. And it's still challenging when it asks you to move to a different string. That's something that you never do in Rock Band or Guitar Hero on a normal controller. There are no strings. It's a very linear. There are five buttons. You only move horizontally along the neck of that thing. You never have to move up or down along the neck. And so all of a sudden, what was basically a two-dimensional, maybe even a one-dimensional game becomes a two-dimensional game. You know, there's a lot more to keep track of. And also the way the notes are represented on the screen is different because it's showing you the six strings and the fret number is just a number, which is very different from the way it's represented with a normal controller where it's all color-coded and the fret number is a color and a position as well. So there's a lot more going on. There's a lot more to keep track of. You have to retrain your hand-eye coordination. And yet, even after playing two or three songs, I felt like I was getting better at it.
Yeah, a little bit. I felt the same way. And it's also just strumming is very, it's completely foreign because, you know, you're actually strumming a string and you have to accurately hit the string to strum properly. Yeah. So it changes the game entirely. It makes it feel completely different.
It is much more physical than playing with the plastic guitar controller. It's very challenging, but I found it immediately compelling. Like, as soon as I played a couple songs with it, I thought, I want to play a lot more with this. I want to learn how to do this. I feel like it opens up a whole new world of what you can do in Rock Band.
Yeah.
And it feels like you're playing a real instrument because you are. And that's something that you can't get with the normal controllers. It was a very, very compelling experience for me. And if I had $300 to burn, it would go to that controller.
Yeah.
Really, it really would. I was very excited about it.
Can you describe the controller a little bit better for me? Because I'm curious, like, what are these strings that you're going to have to replace one day?
Possibly. It is an electric guitar.
It is a real guitar. Can you take it from Guitar Hero or whatever, Rock Band, and then put it into another context, or is it always going to be a controller?
No, it has a jack that you can plug into an amplifier.
Wow.
So you can take it to a stage and play a concert with it. It's probably not the best guitar,
mm-hmm.
but it is a real guitar. And you can actually plug it into an amplifier while you play the game so that you actually hear the real notes that you're plucking while you play the game. And I believe the note layouts within the context of the game are laid out so that you may not be playing all the notes, you know, if you're on the easy or the medium difficulty, you're not playing all the notes that are in the game, but the notes that you do play will fit into the music. So they won't sound out of key or out of place. It's really impressive.
Yeah, it's heavy too.
It is. Yeah, it feels like a real fucking guitar when you pick it up.
Huh.
It really does. And your fingers will hurt after 5 minutes playing this. Your fingertips will be sore. I loved it. I mean, I really want one. I really, really, really want one for my own home. Alright, so now we're going to get into proper new business, and I figured, hey, let's start with Greg, since he couldn't be with us at PAX last week.
Yeah, well, a couple of things. First of all, to follow up from my last new business a couple of weeks ago, I spoke about Final Fantasy VI/3
coming out
in Japan. Well, it's out here as of an hour or so ago.
Jealous.
Which is a surprise, to be sure, but a welcome one, that it would be so soon after the Japan launch, which was just on Tuesday. So that can only mean that it can't be far away in America. But I'm not sure exactly when I'm going to fit it in, because I've decided I'm going all in on the 3DS launch next week.
Whoa.
So I'm not exactly thrilled about this, if you know what I mean. I mean, I've concluded that it is worth it, but not necessarily by all that much.
Greg's like reluctantly buying a 3DS at once.
It's not reluctant. I'm just saying, in economics parlance, my consumer surplus is not that big. So the situation really is just that the deals, the competitiveness of the deals in the UK with the retailers is such that you will not get a better deal later on, I don't think. And you're going to get one, so you may as well get in on it now. In terms of launch titles, I could have settled on Pilot Wings, even though the early reviews, which have been positive, but they're all in sort of agreement that it is very nearly unacceptably light on content. But, I mean, as a launch title, I suppose it's acceptable to me, just about, that it's not hugely based on content, but on, you know, showing off what the system can do and all that sort of thing. And I suppose I didn't really play the airplane stuff in Wii Sports Resort to death, so I can probably tolerate it. But how I used my rare week off in terms of playing stuff, I used it to go back and finish off a couple of playthroughs of games that I've had kind of working very slowly in the background. I managed to sort of kick them into overdrive and finish them off. So first of all, I finished Metroid Prime 2 on the trilogy in hyper mode.
Wow.
And I actually, impressive. For the first time ever in a Metroid Prime game, achieved 100% of the scans.
Wow. Jeez.
Nice.
I've never done it before. I've never really tried to do it. I mean, given that I didn't have a podcast to edit, I had to throw my obsessive compulsive tendency some sort of bone, and I suppose this was it. But I think the good thing is when you replay a game of Metroid Prime, like all the scans you've already done already count. So you've just got a few left, and then I managed to fill in all the blanks and had everything. I got 100% of the items as well, so I completely conquered Metroid Prime 2 this time. And I will say for it, I don't know whether I would go to say it's the best of the three or anything, but I think I enjoyed replaying it the most. I think it benefited a lot from the controls, because there's some sort of more shootery aspects to it than there are to the first one that were taxing the GameCube control scheme a little bit, which now is not a concern at all. And the second thing really is just that the boss fights are so, so much better than they are in the first one. They're so much more interesting, especially the amount of stuff they do with the Morph Ball. So I do enjoy playing through the second one. It is, but I think I appreciate it better. It's grown on me over time because there were some difficulty issues in the original version that were kind of smoothed out. I mean, even playing in hyper mode, I don't think the Boost Ball Guardian is quite as hard as it was originally.
Really?
Yeah. Although it is a lot harder in hyper mode on Trilogy than it is in the Veteran or whatever. It was like, oh, you, I remember you. it was a whole different league of challenges. So, I mean, hyper mode's weird because I feel compelled to do it on hyper mode from the point of view that it feels less like going through the motions. You feel like you're achieving something further, and you see what differences there are, which are usually slim. But the dark side of that is it really exacerbates the problem that pretty much every Metroid Prime game has, that some of the boss fights are too long. And of course, because it tilts the damage health ratio against you, it just makes those fights longer.
Greg, would you play hyper mode in Donkey Kong Country Returns?
What would that be? I guess that would
the
be
bosses
like
the... take 20 minutes instead of 15 minutes.
Yeah, see, yeah. That would be really pushing it, wouldn't it? I wouldn't fancy that, but I really do like Metroid Prime 2 quite a lot.
Yeah, me too. I'm an early defender of that game. I've always loved it, and I think it caught a lot of shit early on. I think it's the least finished of the three games in that series. I think a lot of people really, they need to go back and finish that game because there's some amazing stuff even later on. I mean, what's it called? The
Sanctuary Fortress.
Sanctuary Fortress. It's one of the greatest levels I've ever seen represented in three dimensions. Hmm. It's incredible.
No, there's a lot of cool stuff in there. It's very nice. And and you're right. I mean, it is just the combination of some of the bosses and some of the bottlenecks that you get in the design. I mean, there's some weird things because it's not as connected as the first one. You have those three areas and they're pretty much discrete. They're pretty much like, it's more of a sort of episodic Metroid game, if you like, but there's one little bit of the game where you kind of have to go back and forth between the underwater bog and the Sanctuary Fortress, and it's not really clear how you progress there. And I think a lot of people stopped probably at that point and then missed a lot of more of the cool stuff that you get at the Sanctuary Fortress. But I think with the trilogy, it's quicker and easier to play through. So hopefully people have sort of, like me, gained a greater appreciation for it over time, because I do love just the fact that it is so complex. You know, obviously with Prime 3, they really did scale that back, and there's good things about that. But certainly I like the full experience of Prime 2. It's just very, you know, you have to admire their willingness to make it that way. The only thing is just that loading animation kind of makes the transition between the light and the dark worlds a bit iffy. But because I hadn't got my fix of parallel dimensions, I also finished off a playthrough I've been working on of A Link to the Past, which is my original American cartridge version on my Japanese Super Famicom.
By the way, another Kensuke Tanabe game, which is part of the reason that Echoes does have the parallel world structure, is because of Kensuke Tanabe's influence. He directed A Link to the Past and then had a very strong creative influence over the entire Metroid Prime series.
Yeah, he's their sort of overseer from Japan, Tanabe.
Yes.
Retros, of course. But yeah, so go back to A Link to the Past. This is one of my favorite games ever.
Which, by the way, is better than Landstalker. Holy shit.
who said that?
It was at Retronauts at PAX East at the panel. I got up and I asked a question at the Retronauts panel about some of their favorite, like, obscure, less known 16-bit RPGs, because there are a lot of sort of second-tier, really cool 16-bit RPGs that have never been remade or re-released at all. And one of the guys on the panel brought up Landstalker, which has been re-released anyway a number of times, including on Virtual Console. Also, it sucks. And he said, it's better than Link to the Past. And I said, you are on crack.
Okay, I want to go ahead and say that as a Landstalker fan, I haven't completed the game. I have the original Genesis cartridge. You saying it sucks is completely incorrect.
It's not, I'm exaggerating, but it's not better than Link to the Past.
I'm completely with you on that. Yeah. To say that, I mean, any game that uses that isometric view, but then has, I mean, the Genesis pad was made for
hella
it.
Jumping.
Oh, tons of jumping. The Genesis pad was made for it because it could functionally work in those four directions. But none of the pads that are made for any of the emulated consoles that it's on have that same feature. So the Genesis pad really did work in eight directions. The SNES pad never did.
The Wii Remote doesn't either.
The Wii Remote doesn't. The classic controller does not. So because of that, Landstalker is a little bit unplayable unless you've got it on the original Genesis. And because of just the pure game design, the level of jumping is too much. I want to say that that's one of the great games, though. I'd be willing to put my
stake on
that.
It's the closest thing to Zelda on the Genesis. Sorry for the tangent.
Damn it with faint praise. Okay.
It's no Newtopia, though, on TurboGrafx-16, which is like a straight ripoff. I mean,
they're quite well regarded, aren't they? The Newtopia games.
I think so, yeah. I think
the second one in particular is supposed to be pretty good.
Yeah. Mm.
So, yeah, I said this is one of my favorite games ever. I've played through it many times, but I hadn't actually replayed it all the way through, or even really substantially, since the 90s. I think the last time that I would have replayed it was sometime after Ocarina of Time, but before Majora's Mask. So it was very interesting, just with the passage of time, and of course all the Zelda games that have come since, to put it in a new context. And it was actually, it's a rare thing for me replaying a game. I was really quite surprised at the experience, especially playing the sort of final sections of the game. If I was going to sum it up, I would say it was a lot more like 3D Dot Game Heroes than I remembered. Because, you know, obviously 3D Dot Game Heroes, you know, is shamelessly ripping off Zelda. But the thing about that is, you know, people talk about it as being the sort of Zelda 2 that wasn't, you know, between the original and Link to the Past. And I would still think that's a, you know, pretty apt way to describe it. But its position in between those two games, as I said, seems a bit closer to A Link to the Past, because what really struck me was just that how much less the dungeons were item-driven than they are in the 3D games, or even in the 2D games that have followed, like something like Minish Cap, are much more item-driven than they are in A Link to the Past. Several of the dungeon's main items are things that you don't use in that dungeon at all, or may not really have any meaningful gameplay applicability whatsoever, like the red mail, or the blue mail, or the powered-up version of the power glove, or, you know, all this kind of stuff. Like, a lot of it isn't really gameplay modifying at all. And quite a lot of the rooms in each dungeon may not even have really any puzzles attached to them, and there might be a question of just like, well, it's the ones where you avoid the spinning tiles, or you kill all the enemies in a room, or you simply upturn all the pots until you find a key.
Well, but also, there were more game-changing items between dungeons than you've really seen in the 3D games.
Yeah.
Because now the dungeons have basically become holding cells for really important items.
Yeah, well, this is the thing. The dungeons themselves, there's a bigger emphasis on the fact that I think that they're kind of maze-like. It's okay, you know, the sort of the labyrinth of them later on in the game. You know, for instance, you'll have a situation where the map, everything kind of looks like it's symmetrically laid out and all that, but what you find is there's certain barriers in terms of your blocks to push, or where you have to drop through one floor to get to another, that in fact it's more like a sort of winding line of a trail that you have to follow. And you can't just kind of cut into it wherever you like. And so, yeah, that makes the navigation trickier than it appears. And you do get that kind of stuff in 3D Game Heroes. But it's interesting playing a Zelda game that is so much less inextricably linked with items and dungeons. But, I mean, I think there's really good and bad things about it. I mean, I think one of the good things is that you don't get some of these situations that you have done, especially in the 3D successes like Twilight Princess, where dungeons are over-leveraged on the items, like, say, for instance, the Sky Temple thing in Twilight Princess with the double hook shots. Yeah, it's like, when you find yourself zipping from point to point to point to point, it's like, yeah, I get it, I couldn't have done this without double hook shots, can we just get on now, you know, like, it's you don't get things like that.
Well, and also, that's the only use of that item.
Yeah.
It's really not a terribly useful item outside of that one dungeon.
But I still feel like the double hook shots have a bit more of an importance than what we were talking about. Prior to the podcast, Johnny and I were talking about that spinner item that you get in Twilight Princess that is used to get maybe 2 heart pieces in the overworld and is used to fight the boss in the temple that you get it in and navigate that temple. But other than that, it's just completely not used.
It's such a shame because it's a very
surprising
item. Yeah. It's like one of the few moments in that game that will blow your mind. When you get it, you're like, what the fuck is this thing for?
How will I use this?
Yeah, right. It's
and an then amazing they don't
moment.
Use it.
Yeah.
So I guess that's really interesting. It's an interesting perspective on Link to the Past to me, what I'm hearing from you, Greg, because for me, Link to the Past, and it's been a few years, but I did replay it more than, I would say maybe 6 years ago. I played it on the Game Boy Advance all the way through. And my experience with that game was more that the items were a part of the game. I don't think you use the magic rod too much in the overworld, things like that, but that the game was an integral whole, and Twilight Princess is more made up of individual items used in dungeons, and then you spend your time on the field walking or riding your horse.
Yeah, exactly. That's the big thing. The overworld is much more the star of the show.
Right.
Yes. Yes.
And that's
absolutely
the big difference. And the wonderful thing about A Link to the Past, playing it now, is just how brisk it is by comparison. There's so little dialogue by comparison. There's so little fetch questy stuff. You know, you just kind of could crack on with it. I mean, obviously, you know, if you can remember certain key kind of things that you have to do to access some of these dungeons, which I could remember some of them, that speeds things up, you know, even further. But it is just navigating the overworld. Not only is it quicker and it's easier because it's all just laid out in front of you, you know, because it's a top down game, but it also just feels more brisk because there's always things to do in it. You're always, you know, thinking, oh, well, I, you know, I kind of remember something about that spot over there, you know, cut that bit of grass and that leads to somewhere, and that blow up that wall, that does something. You know, it's dense and feels a lot more continuous because it isn't just a sort of expanse in the middle of things. So that's obviously the big difference. But I guess after years of playing the other Zelda games, had come to remember the dungeons in A Link to the Past as being more like the 3D ones than they really are. I think they're probably, you know, a bit closer to things like the original Legend of Zelda. Just aren't, you know, there's quite a lot of them that really, they're not brain teaser kind of puzzles at all. I mean, if you think of something like the stuff where you're in the spirit tracks or dungeons where you're cooperating with the Phantom Zelda, some of that stuff is really kind of brain teasery kind of puzzles involving like swapping positions, all this stuff. Just, it's so much more advanced than anything you'll find in A Link to the Past. I mean, there's some really wonderful moments in A Link to the Past in terms of, like, you know, like we take the girl into the light and she becomes the boss of that dungeon. And
That's awesome. Yeah.
Some of the interchanges between the dark and the light world. You know, like you have to drain the swamp in the light world to make the second dungeon accessible, all these sorts of things that are really cool, that really stick out in your mind. But sort of on a moment-to-moment basis, it's actually much less puzzle-driven than its successors, which did surprise me, to be honest. And I do think, like I said, it's funny that you could see the influence much more of the 3D Zeldas on stuff like Minish Cap, which really the items are very important to the dungeons in that, like the gust jar and the cape that you could fly and all that kind of stuff. But I do think, you know, it's kind of an obvious thing to say, but there's a sort of happier medium to be found here somewhere where you could take some of that very particular nature of current Zelda dungeons where it's all about this one item and you're constantly using it and sometimes it just seems like it's really kind of perfunctory. But on the other hand, retain the complexity of the puzzles that they've kind of built up to over the years in the series. So Link to the Past is really lovely game to replay compared to other Zeldas because it is so brisk. But it was one of those cases where I kind of had built it up in my mind to be more complicated than it really was.
Hmm. All right, John, show me your Pokemans.
I picked up Pokemon Black and White, mainly due to peer pressure.
Did you get a lot of surveys at PAX East?
No, that was more Obi than me. Yeah, it just seems at PAX East, I always like to have a game at PAX East that is kind of, there's always a game of the year sort of thing at PAX East.
It's always Pokemon, I think.
Pretty much, but there's a huge Pokemon fan base at PAX.
No.
Unsurprisingly. And of course, you know, a lot of people this year just, you know, Black and White just came out. And so, I mean, I had no plans on getting Black and White. I like Pokemon. You know, I'm not a huge Pokemon fan. You know, I like it, but typically, you know, I've never had the urge to catch them all, so to speak. You know, so, you know, when I met, you know, James and Carly and everybody the first night, everybody's like, oh man, you got it. I think who had Pokemon first? Who got it?
Obi had it.
Yeah,
for
Obi.
Sure.
Yeah, Obi had it. Obi was playing it.
He showed up with it.
Neil had it.
So they were just kind of joking, like, you know, like, hey, you should get it. You should get it. All the cool kids are doing it.
Yeah. The fact of the matter is that Carly and I applied the most pressure and neither of us own the game at this moment.
Yeah. Yeah. Neither of you own the game. But, you know, it's like the thing is with other games, I've just been like, oh, whatever. But the thing is with Pokemon is that if you're going to go to something like PAX, it makes perfect sense to have a game like that.
I wished I'd had it.
Yeah.
I mean, I kept seeing people play it and I thought, man, I wish I had this.
Yeah,
I really do. Like, I don't even want to play Pokemon, but I want to have it at PAX.
Yeah. And that's exactly what I wanted. I just wanted to have it at PAX. And, you know, there's certain things where, the further you go in the game, you can open up things where you can get the surveys that, you know, where if you don't turn off your DS, it'll sit there and, like, you know, ping other DSs to get survey results of, like, surveys you fill out, and then it, like, downloads the results from others, and you kind of, you know, you take it to a character in-game, and you can get, you know, just whatever. They give you, like, extra Pokeballs or whatever.
We don't really know what they give, to be honest.
No. Yeah, well, Obi, actually, he cashed it in the one night, and it was just, you know, a bunch of items.
Oh. So nothing worth doing, essentially.
It's worth doing if you want to know if the people around you prefer smart people to good-looking people.
Exactly.
That's the kind of level that those surveys operate.
But yeah, so, you know, I picked it up, and I actually, you know, the one morning I had to drop some people off at the train or pick somebody.
You picked up TYP.
I had to pick up TYP, and his flight came in at like 5 a.m., which I didn't realize until the night before. Like, I thought it was 5 p.m. the night before.
Yes, because we were awoken by his arrival.
Yeah, so I didn't realize. So, you know, this entire time, like, honestly, and I've been talking about picking up TYP for like a month, never even realizing that he was actually taking a red-eye flight in, and then he got in at 5 a.m., and I thought it was 5 p.m., and so the night before, I'm like, oh my God, it's like 8 o'clock at night and he's not here. So that means that the 5 p.m. was actually 5 a.m. I'm like, fuck.
Now, mind you, we all knew it was 5 a.m. We were all fully aware of that fact.
Well, and you probably all thought that I knew that fact.
Yeah.
So therefore, nobody thought that they had to tell me. So yeah, after I found that out, I was kind of like, it's, you know, that kind of sucks because I went to bed at like 2. So I just drove around for a little while, you know, after I dropped off TYP, I was like, it's like 8 a.m. and I'm like, there has to be somewhere around here where I can, you know, because I forgot that I had like an American Express $25 off, you know, gift card or whatever. And so I was like, well, hell, I can get Pokemon Black and White for like $10 somewhere.
If you'll recall, John can't not spend gift cards when he has them.
What else am I going to spend it on? I mean, $25, I mean, what am I going to spend it on? Like,
well, it's American Express. You can spend it on anything.
Yeah, I could spend it on anything.
But that's perfect for Pokemon.
It's perfect for Pokemon because I can get Pokemon, which is a game I wouldn't normally buy, and I can get it for like about $10. So yeah. I waited until Target opened up at like 8 a.m., and so I went in there and picked it up.
I just like the image of you waiting.
I did. I waited.
Open up to buy Pokemon.
I like that you need this level of justification for the whole thing. Like, you have to justify buying Pokemon by, oh, TYP came in at 5 a.m., and I had a gift card.
I mean, if you had told us you waited outside of a Target for Pokemon, I could have made so many more jokes. And it is irresponsible for you to not give me that opportunity.
So, John, you like it?
Yeah, it's good. It's good. I mean, it's Pokemon. I feel like I say that about so many games that I play that are sequels. It's like, it's...
But
it's
this
Halo.
One is really
it's
just
Killzone.
Pokemon.
It's Pokemon, you know.
The
but,
level
yeah.
to which it is Pokemon. On a scale of 1 to Pokemon, it's Pokemon. So.
I mean, it is. I mean, the game really doesn't change. The funniest thing is what Obi and I were joking about is that Obi, one of the things that Obi said he improved, and afterwards, after he said this, we thought it was so funny. Like, we were just like, that. This just says it all. Is he's like, yeah, you know, the text now scrolls a lot quicker. And I was like, and the thing is, the sad thing is, I was like, wow, yeah, that's really awesome. Like, that's some
that
huge is, improvement.
It improves the game substantially.
Yeah. In fact, I'm sitting there like, wow, that just says a lot. The fact that I consider that an improvement on, you know, on what Pokemon has been in the past is pretty sad. But yeah, I mean, there's nothing. It's Pokemon. I mean,
the unchangingness of the formula, I think, is a positive. I think it's one of the great things about Pokemon is that, oh, wait, they came up with about 150 new monsters this time, and it's the exact same game. So I get to play it again, but earn new shit. And so I think if you were 12 and you played every single fucking Pokemon game that was available to you, that might be a bit of a chore. But when you're in your 20s and you pick up like every third Pokemon game, it's a good little respite from the rest of gaming.
Yeah. Pokemon is, I mean, it's a community unto itself, so...
Yes.
You can talk, I mean, people that love Pokemon, you can just talk Pokemon with them, you know what I mean? It's just...
No, you can't. I mean, they can talk Pokemon at you, but you won't understand what they're saying.
Yeah. If there's one thing John needs, it's a respite from other games.
Yeah.
All right, James, what do you have for new business?
So, Johnny might remember back to the Ubisoft event at E3 09, which was considerably less shit than the Ubisoft event at E3 2010.
Well, we were blessed with the presence of one James Cameron, who told us nothing about Avatar for 30 fucking minutes.
That was unimaginable shit, yes. So actually, E3 09 was less hilariously bad than E3 2010, but they were both bad. But one of the games that they actually showed that looked kind of cool was Ruse. And they showed it on the big Microsoft touch table and all that stuff. It had a really cool trailer that didn't show shit, essentially. But I was really excited about that game. I watched some people play it on the show floor since you couldn't touch the Microsoft touch table. Name being totally ironic at that point. But, you know, I never actually got around to the game. I played it again at PAX East. I remember they had a demo kiosk set up there. I remember the person who was working the system basically said, oh, you're the first person who didn't completely screw this up. I'm like, well, that's... not good. I found the demo to be inordinately easy, but whatever. So I then went in recently. I just, for whatever reason, I felt like I wanted to play that game since I just put it off for a long time, and I haven't played a 360 game that wasn't Toy Soldiers since I played Eternal Sonata. So if you don't know what Ruse is, it's a real-time strategy game where the primary objective is the implementation of various so-called ruses to either gain information or convince your enemy of that things are going on, or to conceal what you're actually doing from your opponent.
And then you say over Xbox Live, you got rused.
I haven't had the luxury of screaming things like that at people because they would probably scream other things back that I don't really want to hear. So Ruse is, although you couldn't tell from the initial video, World War II themed. I think it might suffer a little bit for that, but whatever. I've been playing mostly the story mode, which has some of the worst pacing in a real-time strategy game that I've ever seen. I mean, unimaginably terrible pacing. So the game gives you new units at the slowest pace imaginable. It often takes them away from missions. It'll let you use this one type of unit for a little while and then take them away and really restrict your options. So there's only one real answer to solve the intractable issue of removing your enemies. It's like, this is kind of boring. I don't like this. So I went and gave up on the single player mode because it sucks. And I played the individual mission mode, which gives you everything. And that's actually a lot more fun because you can experiment with the different types of strategy you want to use and different combinations of units. But the issue with that being that the default time limit is 25 minutes and you will accomplish shit in 25 minutes. It takes way longer than that to do anything.
But can you change that?
Yeah, you can change it. But my first time I played, it was game over and there had been no conflict yet. Like, we had scouts run into each other a couple times, but that was pretty much the extent of the operation. Final score was 0-0.
You were still turtling, and it's like, okay, this battle's over. The war starts at midnight.
It's
like, what the fuck was this? Like, yeah. I had built up a bunch of tanks. I'm like, all right, I'm almost ready to launch an offensive now. And then nothing happened, and I'm like, wait, why did the game end?
Well, it sounds like you should play it online.
I might have to, because the campaign is rubbish, and the single-player versus AI is basically the same as playing it against a person, except they're not going to be screaming expletives at you. So that's pretty much where that comes in. But what I'm actually impressed by is how well they mapped a RTS to the 360 controller. They actually did a really good job of letting you zoom in and out and select units and control building. So it doesn't make you actually select buildings to instigate the act of building. You just pull up a menu and you can scroll around to your different factories on the... It looks a lot like the old 360 menu, actually.
Hmm. Oh, so it's almost like hotkeys then.
Almost. It looks more like the cross-functioning menu, whatever they call it on Sony systems.
Cross-media bar?
Yeah, so you scroll over to whatever type of unit you want to build, and then you scroll down to a drop-down shows up, and you pick the unit you want, and you select how many you want, and then you say where you want them to go, and it builds.
Doesn't this have move controls on PS3, incidentally?
It does have move controls on PS3, but I've heard mixed things about them. But most of them are that it's terrible and unplayable.
Perhaps they put so much effort into making it work for a traditional pad that the journey back was a bit too difficult.
It works really well with the traditional controller. I was really surprised. And it looks really good. You can zoom way in or zoom way out. There is a certain amount of strategic decision-making that is pretty solid. The few missions where it really gives you free rein to do what you want, those missions actually, you do feel like you've made either terrible boneheaded decisions or really good ones, and you're rewarded or punished accordingly. But, I don't know, the game just, it feels like this game would be really amazing if they didn't totally ruin the single player by the crap they do instead of just giving you controls.
Do you think that was just because they wanted to make it more accessible, that rather than give you the full strategic palette to work with immediately, they wanted you to introduce players to these different, you know, because obviously you're a veteran strategy player, but probably a lot of people playing consoles aren't. So
right.
They kind of wanted to introduce you to the tools of the trade one by one.
Well, so that's kind of what I felt at first, and the game does do some interesting twists on things that other games in the genre don't do. Like, the ability to drop air power or drop airborne units is actually really cool and really useful. And there are scenarios where you can set up ambushes by dropping airborne units. You have to cover them while they get deployed, but for the time being, once they're there, they're actually very effective tools. But the game will give you stuff, force you to use it, so there's no reason why you wouldn't be fully familiar with it. Like, you couldn't complete this mission without making relatively competent use of this item. And then it'll take it away the next mission and give you a different toy to play.
And it also, I suppose, takes the creativity out of solving the problem.
And that's really what it comes down to, because I play strategy games different than the next person who plays them different than the next person. I mean, that's kind of the joy of the genre. You get to make your own decisions and do things your own way. And if they work out, that's great. If they don't, well, it's your own damn fault. Here it's more like, I just have to do what the game's designers wanted me to do. And once you figure that out, and many times the game just tells you, it just doesn't feel right. Like I say, it's still decent, it's just not great.
Well, what do you expect from Ubisoft?
I expect terrible, but not great.
Actually, I have an excellent Ubisoft game sitting on my Xbox right now, Beyond Good and Evil HD, that I haven't played yet.
Beyond Good and Evil's so good.
I got it right before PAX, and I haven't...
So good.
I'm looking forward to playing this, but unfortunately, as is often the case, it is not on PSN yet.
It was a, yeah, it had a timed exclusive thing. It'll be out soon, I think.
I don't know where Nietzsche really enters into the game itself. I don't know why it's named what it's named, but.
No, it's a great game. I can't wait to play it. Speaking of Zelda-ish games, Evan.
No, yes, man. Well, I've been away from, I feel like I'm on this podcast about once every year, and every year I say, oh, I haven't played video games for like a year, but it's literally true.
We actually froze you when you left the podcast, and we've just unthawed you only for this episode.
And I've been exposed to only a few games, a little sampling of Johnny's downloadable selection, and that's where you get to, I mean, can we just talk about Muscle March for half of a second? I mean, I feel like I just entered into, is this the first game that you had me play, Johnny? Because as
no,
soon as
it's
I,
not the first
I,
one.
I disagree with that because,
Evan, welcome to the future.
Yes. As soon as I enter into Johnny's apartment, Johnny's like, hey, sit down, play video games, try Muscle March.
That is,
and the first thing
he's, that's a false account.
The first thing he says to me is, have you taken your vitamins today? I did not know what this meant. I have played Muscle March. I have seen the other side of the veil. And let me say that I wish I had taken my vitamins today. I really, truly wish that had been the case, but it wasn't. Unlike some of the other games he exposed me to, this was a game that I asked him while playing it if I could stop. And he said no. That was a little rough.
Yeah, you're right. It was rough.
Yeah.
Yep. So I moved on. I tried out some other stuff. As far as the downloadable selection goes, I tried out Nobi Nobi Boy. So we went from Muscle March, okay, to Nobi Nobi Boy. Let's just say that if I thought that the drug intake, like in my life, was a bit too extreme, the drug intake in Johnny's life is probably too much, because these games cannot be appreciated while you are in a sober state. I don't know how. I don't know who came up with them. I don't know why they exist.
Well, it greatly depends on your sense of irony to be able to enjoy these games.
There is some of that. I agree. I really do.
Yes. Yeah. Perhaps.
You can deal with the fact you're a polar bear in a Speedo chasing after what is clearly steroids in a jar.
Then you can enjoy Nobi Nobi Boy.
But this is the thing. I feel like I grew to love and not, I didn't want to stop playing Nobi Nobi Boy, or I did not have that feeling with Muscle March at all. Muscle March was, this is absurd, make it stop. And Nobi Nobi Boy was, is this really the game? I want to explore more.
So anyone want to recut this? I mean,
the best part about Nobi Nobi Boy is when Evan paused, because he's like,
uh-oh,
what are the controls? What's going on? And he paused to look at the instructions, and the instructions start out with instructions on how to navigate the instructions.
And then when you find out what the camera controls are, you realize that you have to hit 3 or 4 buttons at the same time.
And tilt the controller.
And tilt the controller. Use the motion axis controller, the 6-axis controller, in order to move the camera. You don't just use the right stick, which, by the way, is not used. You do not use any of the variety
of buttons.
The right
stick is used to move his butt.
Oh, the right stick is used to move his butt.
Yeah.
But if you hold down a button and use the right stick, that would make sense for camera control. That's not what happens. You have the same button. There are plenty of buttons that aren't used in Nobi Nobi Boy, but you use the same button to both eat and jump, which means that you have to, if you're eating fast, suddenly you'll be eating things very fast, and then you'll be jumping. I mean, I'm sure you guys have talked about Nobi Nobi Boy on the podcast before, but just a little recap for the game is that it makes no fucking sense. Like, if I were to describe it to you right now, you wouldn't understand it. You're a giant worm eating things on a like Wetrix board. I'm at a loss.
And then you poop them out, and then you fly.
You poop them out, eat them again, you fly. Occasionally, your game is interrupted to be told that Nobi Nobi Girl has reached Saturn and is on her way to Uranus. And if I knew what that meant, I would tell you.
Oh, you know what it means. You know exactly what it means.
I think Nobi Nobi Boy costs $5. I think it's absolutely worth that to watch people's faces the first time that they play it.
Yes, I agree. And here's the thing is, one of the prefaces that Mr. J. Metz gave to me, JohnnyBoy117, gave to me before I played the game, he said, you will, at the moment that you begin to play this game, be no better or worse than any other person who's ever played this game. I happen to disagree with this because I think I've attained a fair amount of skill in Nobi Nobi
Nobi
Boy.
Nobi Nirvana.
If anybody wants to go head-to-head, Nobi to Nobi, with Evan Birchfield, I swear.
There's so much homoeroticism in this segment.
I will eat you up and poop you out. That's what I'm saying to you right now.
You got rused.
All right, Greg, I'm going to give you a marker. Everything before this point probably needs to go.
I've heard the episode with Evan and Lindy. I knew what was going to happen.
Nobi to Nobi.
So, Evan, what other games?
Of all the things ever said on this show, that might be the most homoerotic.
Don't cross the Nobis.
So, Evan, what else have you played?
You can
Please,
see that...
God, tell us you played something else.
Quick to change the subject. I see how it goes. Okay.
I'm the host. This is what I do.
All right. I played Everyday Shooter.
Yeah.
Which was a surprising excursion into a two-dimensional res, and I loved it. I loved it, and I don't have much else to say about it. I think that everybody who has the opportunity to have played it has played it, and if you haven't, just go spend the $10. Just go buy it. That is an excellent game that needs no justification, and that I just want to function purely as a shill right now to say, if you haven't played Everyday Shooter, play Everyday Shooter.
It's on PlayStation 3.
PlayStation 3, downloadable.
It is really,
content.
Really cool, though.
Yeah, it's a really great game.
Other than that, actual games I've played, I did a little bit of 3D Dot Game Heroes to get a taste of... I mean, I haven't played games in a while. This is one of the ones that was at the top of my list. Johnny had it sitting on his shelf. And I was really excited to see whether Greg was talking about the line between the Nintendo Zeldas and the Super NES Zeldas. By the way, I've never heard of Link to the Past being referred to as Zelda 3. Do you guys refer to that as Zelda 3 at all?
No.
I've heard it referred to
I've heard the term before.
You've heard it before. Do you refer to any of the later Zeldas as like Zelda 5 or 6?
I didn't say I do it. I just said I've heard it.
Oh, okay. Fair enough. I think that's absurd. Link to the Past is the Super NES Zelda, and 3D Dot Game Heroes sort of exists in, I would say, an in-between state between the two. I would agree with Greg on that. However, 3D Dot Game Heroes has a lot more dialogue than Zelda 1 or 2. Maybe it's on the par with Zelda 2, but Zelda 1, so much more. But I was really excited to see a 3D representation of a two-dimensional Zelda world, because one of the things that Johnny and I have been talking about as I was playing it is how ineffectual the overworlds have been in pretty much every 3D Zelda sans Wind Waker. Wind Waker has an excellent overworld only because they're willing to make it spare with things growing out of it so that you will find unexpected elements. You do not find anything unexpected in Ocarina of Time. You rarely find anything unexpected in Majora's Mask. I would go so far as to say you don't find anything unexpected in Twilight Princess. And that makes an overworld boring. Shadow of the Colossus, the premise is that you will not find anything unexpected, so just enjoy the environment. That works. This is a problem I have with the overworlds and three-dimensional Zeldas.
Yeah, I mean, we were talking about in 2D Zeldas, and especially in A Link to the Past, I think, which has... I mean, one of the fun things about it is the overworld is the game. I mean, you're either in a dungeon or you're in the overworld, and there's really nothing else. There are no segmented areas as there are in Ocarina of Time and a lot of the other games. So you can be out in the overworld roaming around exploring and find a house, and there's a guy there who will sell you a shield. You know, and you're not going to find that in the 3D Zeldas. It kind of doesn't exist.
Yes.
Because the towns are a separate place. There's a transition there. You can't really see them well from the overworld. Mm-hmm. That is a fun thing in the 2D Zeldas, is that the overworld is integrated with the rest of the game.
Yes.
And everything exists in that same space. And it gives you a feeling that when you explore, you could find anything.
Absolutely. And so 3D Dot Game Heroes gives a quasi three-dimensional look at that world, potentially, if it had been in 3D. Now, it's not fully 3D, but I'm sure that all the listeners who played it, all of you guys who played it, you understand that it is a two-dimensional experience with a little pizzazz. That makes it wonderful. It's also fucking hard. So, I mean, I played the first two dungeons, got stuck on a couple bosses, already was fairly upset about it, but all I want to say is that is the experience that I think it's intended to be. I've heard it gets a little bit harder towards the end. This is a game that I would, and this is not what you would expect as a, like, you wouldn't use it as a tech demo for a PlayStation 3, but this is the reason that I would buy a PlayStation 3 to have experiences like this if it wasn't the only experience. If I could have repeated experiences like this, I would have a PS3 fast.
And I think there will be a 3D dot Game of Heroes 2.
Excellent.
It did sell really well for Atlus, and I think that probably will get a sequel at some point after Demon's Souls 2 or whatever
right. that's Dark Souls, is it?
Yeah. After that game, I do think they'll make another one. I'm kind of excited. I would love to see them do the same thing that they did with the first 3D dot Game of Heroes, which is take sort of the original Zelda 1 graphics and just make them into 3D pixel art. I'd kind of like to see that same approach with A Link to the Past, so it all look kind of a little more colorful, a little more sophisticated, but the same basic approach, mm-hmm. and also follow on with the gameplay and take it to the next generation. Mm-hmm. All right, so I'm going to wrap up new business with Dead Space 2, which I got about a month ago, I guess, and I sort of took my time playing through it because I had other games coming in and out. But I really did enjoy Dead Space 2 a lot, and the reason I wanted to bring it up is that I think it has a number of interesting tie-ins with Nintendo games. You know, of course, the first Dead Space was known as very much a direct follow-on to Resident Evil 4, which started on GameCube, of course, and it had elements of Metroid in that there was some exploration, there were occasionally... I think, actually, the comparison to Metroid's a little overblown, but some people did feel like at least... atmospherically, it had things in common with Metroid Prime in that the environments are extremely detailed. There's certain things about the pacing, the way that the levels are sort of segmented off, so you have to go through these doors where there are load times, things like that. I mean, I get it. I mean, I see where those comparisons are coming from. I thought they were a little bit misplaced. Dead Space 2 feels much less like Metroid. I really think that comparison is completely invalid at this point. Just because of the way the game is structurally a bit different, it's more linear. I think there are fewer doors that you have to wait to go through. There are a lot more elevators, so it's got a bit of Mass Effect syndrome, yeah. where there's a lot of waiting for elevators.
Gotta get that load time.
Oh, yeah. But actually, the two things that I wanted to bring up about Dead Space 2 is that, first off, I think this game really owes a debt of inspiration to Eternal Darkness. Because your character, Isaac Clarke, who is really a character in this game. He was more of a faceless avatar in the first game. In this game, he has a voice, he has a face, you see him, he interacts more directly with other characters, and he's going insane over the course of this game. He has these hallucinations, these visions, these altered perceptions of what's going on in the environment. It's not tied to any particular game mechanic, they're more like cutscenes. And which was, you know, when we talked about Eternal Darkness, when we did retroactive on it early on a couple years ago, I think we discussed this, but there is like a very uneasy alliance of gameplay and storytelling with the sanity effects and the insanity scenes, because there's this meter that you're sort of managing, and you kind of know when insanity effects are about to be onset because the meter's low, and so you kind of expect that things are going bad. And then at the same time, when you do get into an insanity effect, for the most part, you know that it's not going to have any lasting effect. I mean, I think there are a couple that can affect your health, but for the most part, you sort of watch them, and then it flashes white, and then, oh, that never happened, and then you keep going.
Right.
So Dead Space 2 is much more that way, because there is no gameplay mechanic attached to it. It just happens at certain points in the game. You can't avoid it. It's going to happen. And you just watch it. And after a while, I felt like I come up on these moments. I feel like it's done in a sort of a clunky way. Because you come on these moments, something happens that couldn't possibly be real, and you have to just wait for it to play out. Because you know it's going to be, oh, that wasn't really real. It's kind of, that happened a lot in Black Swan, too. I don't know if anyone's seen that movie, but there's a lot of just bullshit that happens. You're like, well, I know this isn't real, so now I just have to wait for this to end so we can get back to the real shit, you know, for the story to progress. So it's interesting. I think in some ways it's actually handled less elegantly than in a 2002 GameCube title, you know, from Silicon Knights. But it certainly does owe that debt to it. It's very clearly inspired by it. And it's interesting because I think not that many games have replicated the psychotic insanity syndrome that Eternal Darkness introduced. Very few games have actually tried to approach that since then. So I do like to see that it's being continued and that other people are trying for it.
There's quite a lot of that in Extraction, isn't there? Like, the first mission strongly hints that you've been going around shooting stuff thinking they're necromorphs when maybe they weren't.
Right, right. Yeah, I kept thinking maybe that would happen in Dead Space 2. Like, maybe you'd play all through the entire game and then find out that you'd been shooting healthy people the entire game. That doesn't happen. You're shooting zombies the whole time. But, yeah, I mean, I do think that's an interesting space to mine creatively from a game design standpoint, the idea that your main character is going crazy and that what you see may or may not be real, but Dead Space 2 doesn't do a great job of it. What it does do really excellently is zero gravity gameplay, which we saw in the videos for Cosmic Walker. You know, I work on spacesuits. I'm very interested in that. That's sort of my professional life. And the idea that there are video games that could sort of accurately represent spacewalking, extravehicular activity in three dimensions has not been explored very well, I think. And so I was really excited for Cosmic Walker, you know, the idea that maybe with Motion Plus or something that you'd be able to control this really well and that Nintendo could create a compelling gameplay experience. And apparently Nintendo decided at some point they couldn't, or that they're not ready to. I do think that game maybe will return on a different system eventually.
Steel Diver gives hope for everything, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it might actually make sense for 3DS. Or maybe they're just, you know, maybe they just want more time to cook the ideas and figure out how to design a game around it. Dead Space 2 has, you know, there were zero gravity elements in the first game, but, you just have these magnetic boots. It was done a lot like Star Trek First Contact, where you're always sticking to some surface. So before you unattach from the current floor, you need to choose a spot on an opposite wall that you're going to fly to.
Yeah, now I thought those were actually really fun because of the way they did it, because they actually had rooms where you would have to go through these portals and they would like wind around. So you had to kind of figure out the right angle to go through these portals to get where you wanted to go. It was really cool.
Yeah, no, I have no problem with how it's done in the first Dead Space, but I much prefer the way it's done in the sequel. Because in the sequel, they're like, okay, well, you can stick to any surface. You still have the magnetic boots, so you can walk around on any surface that you want to. But once it goes zero gravity, you're better off just free-floating because you have these rockets all over your suit, which, nerd alert, from an engineering perspective, is very inefficient. There's really no way to do that in a practical way. But hey, in the sci-fi setting, let's go for it. You know, he can jet around forever, and it's awesome. It feels really good. The controls are set up in, I think, a very smart way that makes it approachable. It's not overly confusing. It's not, you know, you still have the locator thing that will sort of paint a line to the exit, to the next place you're supposed to go, and it works really well, even in these very open 3D environments. And yeah, basically you fly through, it's like the ultimate jetpack. I mean, you basically just let go, release yourself from the surface that you're standing on, and now you can float anywhere. You can spin around, you can change your orientation, you can make the floor the ceiling and the walls the floor. It's really exciting, and it has the potential to be very confusing and frustrating, and it's not. And I think the design that went into that is really impressive. I mean, it just kind of, when you play it, you don't think much of it because it just works. Like, you see where you need to go, and you just go there, and it feels cool, and you're like, hey, I'm flying through this room. It's really nice. But if you think about the level of design that must have gone into that to make it make sense, you know, to make it feel right, to make it feel like you are actually floating and flying through this, it's awesome. Those are by far my favorite parts of the game. And the nice thing is the pacing of the game is such that you can kind of tell when the designers were making Dead Space 2, they knew this was awesome. They knew this was like the coolest part of the game. So they put a lot of it in there. And they made very good use of the 3D environments. I mean, even though you can fly freely through them, you can't just do it willy-nilly. There are obstacles in the way. There are enemies shooting at you. You have to be kind of careful, and you always feel like something awful is about to happen. So you do want to go through it cautiously, even though you have this very free range of movement. It's really impressive, and again, it makes me wish that Cosmic Walker would be revived at some point, because I would love to see more games like this. And you know, hopefully with Dead Space 3 or whatever, I do want to see more games approach this sort of free movement in three dimensions, because I think it's really cool, and I think there's a lot more you can do with it. But that is, if that alone is, to me, makes Dead Space 2 worth playing through.
Yeah, I mean, with all of the zero-G stuff in the first game, I mean, I just thought it was actually interesting, because you wouldn't think, I mean, so what? I mean, you can kind of get the concept of it, but to actually play it and realize that it makes sense for you to look straight up and then go straight up. Like, you're so used to just playing 3D games where you're just effectively just walking along a platform, you know, and up is up, down is down. You don't really have to think of things in 3D, really. You're just playing a 3D version of a 2D game.
Yeah. Okay, now we finally come to the end of New Business, and we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll do just a bit of listener mail. So stick around.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
Kicking off Now Playing this week, we have the Mega Mario blog. An early adopter of 3DS makes his own custom augmented reality card to generate a humongous Mario statue. Must see photos in that article. And next up we have Nintendogs Plus Cats Journal, in which Danny provides an ongoing report on his progress with both dogs and cats in the 3DS launch title.
Speaking of 3DS,
oh no,
we have a bunch of 3DS launch previews for you. Multiple staff members have contributed previews of the various 3D launch titles. If you're wondering which games to pick up on launch day, this is a must-read. Also, Extra Life Star Fox 64. Josh Max shares his fond memories of the best Star Fox game, according to him.
I think it's more according to Johnny, actually.
Yes, according to me.
We have our complete coverage of PAX East, including a large gallery of photos featuring staff members as well as cosplay and Mr. Do. I was at PAX East. Don't look at the pictures. We have impressions of Super Monkey Ball 3D from Jared, which is Sega's 3DS launch title, which features both tilt and analog controls.
All right, finally, we have impressions from Aaron Kaluska on Dream Trigger, which is an unpublished late-era DS game that combines elements from both Mega Man and Ikaruga. So read his report and cross your fingers that this game will find a home on DS. And finally, Cartoon Network Punch Time Explosion from Crave Entertainment. I know what you're thinking. This sounds horrible.
That's seven words together.
I understand. Aaron played this at GDC, and he assures us this is a totally competent, really exciting 3DS version of Super Smash Bros. Featuring characters from Cartoon Network. Check it out. Seriously, like, he thinks it's awesome. It could be really a surprise hit. All right, so all that great original content is over at NintendoWorldReport.com. Go check it out right now. And we're back with listener mail. The address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And if you didn't get a chance to ask us a question at the live panel last week, this is the way to do it. Send us an email. We'll get to it, hopefully. So Greg has the first email.
This is Steve from Kenosha, Wisconsin, and he writes, Radiant Historia has been much lauded by the gaming press and, of course, our own James Jones. A week after its release date, I couldn't find it at Best Buy, GameStop, or Amazon. Generally, I wait until games drop in price and pick them up months later, but I'm now getting quite panicked. I don't want to miss out on what sounds like a classic in the making, or at least the spiritual successor to Chrono Trigger. I know Atlus make limited runs, but this is ridiculous. Is there any chance that they will make another batch? Help me, RFN Kenobi. You're my only hope.
Yeah, probably not.
They will go through, it will go around every so often and do secondary runs, but I'm looking at Amazon right now and it looks like they've got it in stock.
Oh, okay.
Pun not intended, since the main character's name is Stock. But
with an E. With
maybe
an E,
that was yes. A temporary shortage when right. Steve originally
well,
wrote
it. It probably is a second run. Atlus probably pushed another run out the door.
I can't really afford it right now, but I'm strongly thinking about just going ahead and ordering a copy while I still can.
It might not be a terrible plan.
And then shipping it to Steve, right?
No. Yes. No, that's for me.
I mean, the reality of the situation is the game's not going to get cheaper.
Right. No, exactly. Sure. If for I sure. can get it for face value, that's probably a good deal.
Yeah.
But yeah. Amazon Marketplace is a good place to go, though. I feel even for games, it's a solid collection of, and overpriced a bit, good place to go for Atlus games even in particular.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, it is a higher end DS game. It's $35.
Right.
Well, I mean, when we were at the PAX East panel for the Video Game Antique Roadshow, which I think we can agree, other than ours, was the best panel at PAX.
maybe that one, but the one y'all skipped, the one from OC Remix, was actually really awesome.
Oh yeah, I would have liked to have seen that. But the, you know, it was Chris Kohler's panel, the Antique Roadshow. It was awesome and really entertaining. One of the things that they mentioned is that a game like Panzer Dragoon Saga, part of the I mean, of course it was rare, it was a very limited run in the first place, but part of the reason that it goes for a very high resale value is that people tend to acquire that game and then hold it forever because it's a good game. So the value of it, it's interesting. The value is not high because it's a high quality game. It's because there's a high demand and a low supply, because the actual number of copies out there available on the market is low, because people tend to buy it for $300 or whatever they paid for it on eBay, and then they keep it forever. So that copy is now complete. So the value only goes up and up and up because there's an increasingly smaller number. And I feel like with these Atlas games, it might actually be the same, the same way. So yeah, I'm kind of with Steve here. I'm like, damn, maybe I need to go get a copy of this while I still can afford it.
It's not a problem you would have with like a Sega CD game that's like a hockey game from 1994.
Right. Or like Chris Cross making the video. True.
Those are all over the place because everybody's happy to get rid of all their copies of
They'll
those.
Pay you to take it.
Well, my goal with Chris Cross is to buy every single copy out there, corner the market, and then make millions. Discuss.
Millions.
It's John's reimagined of Goldfinger.
Exactly. No, Crisscross, I expect you to die.
He's going to radiate every other video game in the world.
Must play on the busted ass Sega CDs.
He's going to sell Crisscross to all the people who missed the bus on it the first time.
Nice.
There's a whole collection of like 14 fans of Crisscross living in the South
John's
somewhere.
Punchline to be, I was going to gather all the copies and then burn them.
warm it up, Chris. Maybe, yeah.
Yeah, so I guess our collective advice to Steve is, yo, hit up Amazon and maybe your local stores as well if they have repressed
it. Yeah, I mean, it could have come back in, I'm not sure.
Yeah,
but
that's what I'll be doing.
It looks like they've got 13 copies in stock as of recording on Thursday, so.
Okay, well, and yeah, and Steve, by the time the show goes out, if you can't find it, haha, I bought Joe's, so.
Wow.
Yep.
Such loving relationships.
Unfortunately, if you are in Europe, you're pretty much going to have to get this off eBay. Because there's still nothing about that.
Yeah.
Why is the hole getting deeper? I don't understand what's going on.
No, I think you know, with Radiant Historia getting excellent reviews and apparently selling well, you know, if Atlas ends up doing multiple printings and they all sell out, then maybe the pressure on European publishers to pick up that game, pick up the rights, and distribute it in Europe will go up. Mm. So I feel like the better it does in America, the higher the chances are that it will eventually be published in Europe. Okay, so...
All right, Brian S. from Wantage, New Jersey writes, on March 6th, I had absolutely no intention of buying Pokemon Black or White. I was planning on getting it eventually, but not on its launch day. A couple of hours and $33 later, I had it. I don't know what willed me into buying it, be it some kind of magic or whatever. What I want to know is if you guys have had any similar experiences.
John, have you had a similar experience to this?
Yeah, I think Brian S. had to pick up a friend from the airport was the situation.
Yes.
5 a.m. road trip and, man, then Pokemon.
Yep.
I was out on the town, yada, yada, yada. I had Pokemon.
I contracted Pokemon Black.
Went to the bar, got drunk, yada, 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 Pokemon.
Woke up in my bed, Pokemon was sitting next to me. I don't know what to say.
Yeah. Well, I mean, James, you've talked about this before, how you'll...
But see, I'm actively seeking out the experience of going to a store and just saying, what hits me?
Right, but you don't plan ahead on what you're going to buy.
That's not true. I pick out games ahead of time, but I also like to just go out there sometimes and just get something.
Touch Detective was like that, wasn't it? Where you just kind
of
ended
up with
it.
Well, Touch Detective was an influenced purchase, let's put it that way.
From wherever, I couldn't imagine.
He was gaming under
figure.
The influence.
I wonder what that was.
Well, I always plan my purchases ahead very strictly. This is probably a legacy from being an import gamer back in the days when they cost a hell of a lot of money, that you were very careful about what you buy. And even now with downloadable stuff, I tend to be unreasonably fastidious about how I approach these things. So it certainly hasn't happened yet. If it had, probably, you know, I might have ended up with Target Terror or something. Certainly disaster, because there was a period where disaster was going really cheap in Europe, but even I just couldn't justify, even on an irony basis, I couldn't justify.
I'm pretty sure having Target Terror would be a positive experience.
We should, you know, we need to choose our new retroactive game pretty soon. I'm thinking Target Terror.
It's not gonna be fucking Target Terror.
That should be in the running.
I want to go and say that this whole like impulse buying thing happens to me more often when I'm trying to show back, especially back in the day when the Wii was a new system, trying to show people Virtual Console and having them always request to play the very games that I had not already downloaded. And then it's just like, oh, okay, I'll download this. And now I've got, like, I've got copies of, I've more shooters than I've ever needed on the virtual console on the Wii. I've so got, two. I've got
Lords of Thunder.
I've got Toe Jam and Earl. Like, nice. I don't need that.
Back to Funkatron, baby.
John needs Toe Jam and Earl. Need Toe Jam and Earl. Else does.
Why is it that when you move in that game, it looks like you're playing hopscotch, like you're taking the slowest possible route to get to wherever you're trying to go? You literally, like, you are a giant Play-Doh blob in that game. No one should spend $8 on that.
To be fair, I just impulse bought Touch Detective 2.5, so fuck me.
2.5.
Has that got Leslie Nielsen in it?
That's what it's called. They call it 2.5.
R.I.P. Nate Dogg and Leslie Nielsen.
Yes. Oh, that is tragic.
Oh, yeah.
That's sad.
So I think the whole impulse thing really only happens to me when I'm getting ready for a big trip. Because I'm normally more like Greg. I do tend to research my game purchases ahead of time. I sort of know Amazon Prime has made it so that the barrier, the amount of research I will do before a game or the amount of trepidation I have before I commit to buying is much lower. But yeah, in general, I do, you know, I'm not going to buy a game I've never heard of. Mm-hmm. I generally have, you know, do so very intentionally. But before I'm going for a trip, I have this ritual where, when I have dispensable income, which is why I didn't do it before PAX, but, a lot of times before a big trip, I will go to the store and basically be like, I'm going to buy the first DS game that catches my eye. And of course, I know a lot about the DS library, so it's not like I'm going to see something I've never heard of and be like, what is this? I'm going to buy it. But I will buy something that I've heard of that I've always
My pet horse, DS.
Yeah. But I will buy something that I've heard of and I've always wanted to try, and I just never did. And I, you know, if I see it at the store for like $10, okay, that's mine.
Yeah.
You know, and I'll play that, and that will be like my vacation game. And you know, I've come up with some interesting things over the years, like Shirin the Wanderer sort of ended up being kind of like that.
Right. I walked out of a store once with, I think I was only intending to buy Okami, but I walked out with both Okami and Shadow of the Colossus and maybe even Dragon Quest VIII.
Wow, that's all a hell of a trio.
Yeah, it was really seriously, like, I don't know. I haven't finished any of the, I've finished Shadow of the Colossus, but I haven't finished the others to this day. But, I went and told Stan Ferguson about this and he said, oh, are you going to artsy fart yourself to death? And I just told him he was an asshole and then never spoke to him again.
That's not true. okay, James has the next letter.
The next letter is from Ken T. He writes, does anyone know if the 3DS buttons are clicky like the DSi XL, solidary to bro James, or DS Lite-like and squishy? Also, due to Sony's NGP's back touchpad, I propose we call it the PlayStation Reach-Around.
That's awesome.
So I'm willing to come up with new names for the NGP since that's already fucking taken by a handheld.
It won't be called the NGP.
No. It can't be because something already was. But yeah. They are clicky, aren't they? I mean, I just played it 5 days ago, but
yeah, it is clicky. Yeah, I mean I don't have much experience with DSi or XL, but I would compare it to maybe GBA SP.
I didn't maybe this way going between it and the XL. I didn't notice a difference. I wasn't looking for it either, which is stupid because this letter had already come in and I should have been paying attention to it. But
no, it definitely is. Because I can remember when I went to the E3 in London, you know, event last year. You know, I was playing my DS Lite on the way in on the train, and then I got to play 3DS and a bunch of stuff that was set up on DSi XLs. And the 3DS and the XL are much, much, much closer together than they are to the Lite.
Yeah. And the D-pad is very clicky as well.
Yeah, the D-pad is the DSi D-pad.
It's surprisingly small.
I
found the D-pad was like, whoa, this thing. I mean, it is in it. You know, Matt Walker was telling us how he can't really play Street Fighter with the D-pad because of the position. It's way down in the corner on 3DS. And there were
relegated.
A couple games. Yeah, it does seem kind of tucked away in the corner, and I found that I tried to use it in a couple of the 3DS demos at PAX, and I found it was kind of hard to get my thumb down to it, which makes me wonder, you know, about virtual console handheld games that you might want to play with a D-pad. Is that really going to be comfortable? But at the same time, they'll probably will let us use the circle pad for that. And
they do, yeah. The circle pad even functions for old DS games. I mean, obviously, you know, it doesn't make the control in Mario 64 DS analog. It can't, but at least, you know, it doesn't force you to sort of reach down to control the game.
Well, right. I think it makes the diagonals just a lot easier to use.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah, just because of the physical. But obviously when it comes to, in Mario 64 DS, I actually had to put a run button in it to kind of compensate for that fact that you didn't have the analog controller. And so that, obviously, all that kind of game design stuff remains constant.
Right.
I think that it is very, very similar to my experience with the XL, albeit smaller.
Yeah, it's a lot smaller than the XL.
Shockingly smaller.
Yeah, the XL is massive. I saw it for the first time when James brought it to PAX.
Was it Kohler we were talking to that basically said it was hard to go back to from the XL to that thing?
Yeah, Chris Kohler is a huge fan of the XL.
He and I are in total agreement on the XL.
I think a lot of people like that. Jeremy Parrish likes it too.
The XL is the penultimate DS.
When I saw it next to the 3DS, I said this at the time, I kind of felt similarly. Once you've seen the grandeur of it, it's kind of difficult.
It's massive, yeah.
I would love to get an XL. It's such a redundant purchase for me, especially
it's a luxury pick, big time.
Yeah, I mean, I really can't afford it because it's it does things that other devices I have already do. So it just makes no fucking sense for me to buy one. But I would like to have one. I do think it's really cool.
Yeah.
Well, when I first got it, actually, I just couldn't get over how big it was. The screen's actually the bigger problem because it's basically the size of the two original DS screens together.
Well, doesn't that give you the comfort of being able to hold it farther away from you?
Oh, yeah.
Because the screens are... No, really, because the screens are bigger, so you don't have to strain your eyes as much.
To be honest, most of the time, the size is so different, it can literally sit on the table as opposed to having to hold it.
No, I think that would be great. I mean, it seems like you could relax. You could play it on the couch or whatever, and you wouldn't have to worry so much about your posture while you're... Which is going to, again, going back to 3DS is really a step backwards, because with 3DS, you really have to pay attention to your posture.
Well, and the 3DS screen is quite a bit smaller.
It is smaller, but with the 3D effect as well. You have to be very conscious of how you're holding it and what angle and how far away it is from you. And the DSi XL just seems like such a total obliteration of that. Just, you can see it, they talk about the viewing angle and everything. They went from having the best viewing angle ever on the XL to the worst ever on the 3DS. Yeah. It's a weird step back. And I wonder if, when they do eventually revise the 3DS hardware and they bring out the new sexy version of it, is it going to play to some of those revisions that they've done before, where now the screens are bigger and they're easier to see from different angles and it's easier to hold and it's just more ergonomic?
I would have thought so. Once they miniaturize some of the components in it, presumably, as they will in time, then they'll have more room for a bigger battery, and presumably the screens will get refined.
I mean, we know that. Here's the best example I can come up with for it. Right now, there is an alternate battery that's already been announced for the 3DS that gives it twice the battery length, I think. It makes the unit itself so big that it's untenable to use.
Well, it's a third-party thing, of
course.
Right,
but I mean, that's what you'd have to do to get the extra juice.
Oh, yeah, it's the thing, I assume, because it's, three screens, as we said before, effectively, and all that. I mean, the problem they had is they wanted something that still conform to the broad form factor of the current DS systems, but with the new hardware really limited them to a battery that really isn't up to the precedents that they've set with their previous hardware. So it'll have to take the rest of the system to get smaller in effect, so they can get a battery, and I'm sure they could get better performing batteries in the future as well.
They can also potentially move to something like organic LED screens like the Sony NGP
uses. Those have issues though.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it's not the easiest thing to do, especially when you have the 3D and you have multiple screens on it. The NGP doesn't have to worry about that, but those screens do draw less power. So I think the whole device potentially could become more efficient with later technology revisions.
And I think they will make it a priority. I don't think the fact that this has lackluster battery life means that the Nintendo no longer cares about it. I think they still hold it as a priority. It's just kind of ended up getting shunted down the list.
It's the best they could do right now.
Yeah, due to the particular constraints of the hardware design at the moment. But those will change.
Sure. Right. I mean, and you have situations that they've shunted down quite a bit of things down the priority list for this particular piece of hardware, including the operating system being complete.
All right. So the final question today comes from James in Louisville, Kentucky. And he writes, "The question I have is about good games to play with kids. I game more with my nephew, who's 5 years old, than I do by myself nowadays. We play a lot of Mario Kart, Ben 10, Lego Batman. One of the most fun lately has been the 2D Batman The Brave and the Bold that just came out. It's easy and very witty. It's been a blast to play through, although it is a bit shallow. I'm looking for other games to play with him and not sure what would be good. He really doesn't like playing games where we play against each other, although I try not to win or lose too much. I've thought about getting Super Smash Bros. Brawl, but not sure if he would be into it. I did get Donkey Kong Country Returns for Christmas, and that was actually really fun to play together for the first couple worlds. After that, though, it's just too difficult and frustrating to play with two people, more so when one of them is five, even if he does ride on Donkey Kong's back most of the time. Would Sonic Colors be a playable game for a five-year-old, and what other games would you recommend for this situation?
So we have Epic Yarn, right?
Yeah, Epic Yarn is Kirby is a really great one.
We also have what is the name of that game? I'll think of it. Go on.
I was just gonna say that I have an 8-year-old nephew, and he started gaming with me when he was 5. He's already, it sounds like from the situation, that you're already playing the Lego Batman games, or the Lego games in general. Lego Batman's good. Lego Indiana Jones. I have gotten so much play out of Lego Star Wars with my nephew that game I had to bequeath it to him when I moved away from the state that he lives in, because that is very much his experience with video games. The Lego games are not as exciting for an adult once you've been through them once, but I mean, let's admit it, when you're that young, you can play a shit game and enjoy it.
I disagree. I think that's
what I mean. I'm not trying to say the Lego games are shit, but you can play a shit game.
I don't think you should give shit games to children, even if they don't know that.
Okay, maybe so, but depending on your philosophy, at the very least, the Lego games are not bad in any way.
I would say that young players don't know what's bad, but I think in some cases they're more demanding than anyone else. But they can be very much more tolerant of certain things about a game that aren't very good.
Certainly.
If they like the kernel of it, then they'll look past some. If you think of old NES games, which were like completely inscrutable.
Mylon's Secret Castle.
I mean, if you haven't seen the breadth of games out there, then, I mean, you're not going to know all the kinds of different game mechanics, the way different things have been done in different games. And so you're just going to see something. Yeah, like you're not really. I mean, you're not going to see when something is done
poorly. But at the same time, kids aren't dumb. They can tell when a game sucks.
Right.
My aversion to that sentiment comes from all the shit that THQ used to produce. Like, well, it's a game for kids. It doesn't have to be the same level of quality.
Right. I don't think that's on the same level, though, because what you have are a variety of games that we as adults understand function in some way, but I think what Greg was saying is exactly correct. They have certain things holding them back. Those can be the most addictive things available. So my recommendation is to, although it's nice to buy new games, definitely avoid Super Smash Bros. Brawl. I tried that.
It doesn't seem like a good game to play with a much younger person, especially if you don't want to be competing against each other.
It certainly can be. I mean, I suppose you could turn a lot of things down, you know, items and, you know, number of players and whatnot, but it's very visually busy. That could be problematic.
Yeah. So I would throw out Virtual Console, I think, is a great resource.
Yeah.
Get him started on the classics. One that I would recommend, maybe not for a 5-year-old, but more like an 8-year-old, is Gunstar Heroes. I think that's an excellent cooperative game. You can alternate in Super Mario Brothers. These are just general, obvious things that really work. The things that you grew up on can very, very easily become the things that your children or younger people in your life can grow up on. So find out, figure out, go back in your little nostalgia factory and figure out what was the best thing for you. Those are the things, even if they are not so great today. Blaster Master
is great today.
It is great. No, we're throwing out Blaster Master. Yeah. I'm going to throw out even like things like Frogger. Some of these, if they've got an updated version, great to look for. That's the stuff that keeps my nephew going.
Oh, there's no shortage of updated versions of Frogger.
Unfortunately. Yeah,
sure. There's a good one on Vectrex, actually. So you can get a hold of that.
This might be a little over his head right now. And I would advise against playing it with just two people.
Sins of a Solar Empire.
Yes. I was thinking it was Fear, actually, but
for three.
Yeah. Dokapon Kingdom is one of the best multiplayer games on the Wii.
Oh.
Oh yeah, that's like Mario Party, but different.
But with RPG elements, yeah.
I always wanted to play it. You know, we should have busted that out at PAX. That would have been a great one to, like, do in the console free play together.
They didn't have it, but it's really awesome.
Yeah.
And I wish I owned a copy of it. I've only played it a couple times, but it is really, really cool.
Well, I mean, I guess a lot of people might think of this more as a competitive multiplayer game, but the Boomblox games do have co-op modes. And
they
I think kids would find that fun because there's an element that's just like a toy box kind of element to those games.
Well, you're breaking things, and kids
but
like to
make
break
sure
things.
Your nephew wears the wrist strap. Seriously, for Boomblox, it really does come into play. So.
Yeah. And, you know, just Wii Sports, Wii Fit has a lot of fun mini games that are worth doing, even though that's not cooperative. And if Super Mario Brothers works, you can always, instead of doing Donkey Kong Country Returns, which I've sampled a little bit here at Johnny's apartment, very difficult. The original Donkey Kong Countries, especially the first one, are excellent for a young age. That's the stuff I grew up on. So those are alternating in the same vein. So also good choices for that age.
And then on the Sonic Colors issue, now, I haven't played it co-op.
Wait, is there co-op in that game?
Yes, there is, but it's limited because what it is you know those levels that you unlock through collecting the red coins that are sort of, you know, visually sparse? They've got the kind of 8-bit thing going on. Did you ever play any of those, Johnny?
No.
I could just tell by how he dismissed you, the answer was no.
Those levels are the only ones, I believe, that you can play in co-op. You can't play the normal levels. So you would have to unlock the levels first to play them in co-op. And then I don't think they're necessarily, you know, the best levels in the game from what I've played of them. And also just from reading reviews, it doesn't sound like Sonic Colors really works as well as a co-op game, you know, as maybe Kirby does or New Super Mario Bros. Wii, you know, so it doesn't really seem like a particularly strong candidate.
Yeah. Right. But, you know, I think New Super Mario Bros. Wii potentially, I mean, it can be frustrating in multiplayer for sure, but...
A little bit.
If the two players aren't overly antagonistic towards each other, and I feel like if you're playing with a kid, that's probably less of a problem.
It's more a problem for you to not accidentally murder him.
Yeah.
Than it is for... Yeah.
There
you gotta watch yourself.
There could be some accidental, you know, pushing each other off ledges and things like that. But that game could actually be a lot of fun to play with each other. And, you know, there's a lot of games on Wii that have these sort of optional... You know, sometimes we refer to them as girlfriend modes or something.
Sure.
That's a very demeaning way to put it. But it's, you know, it's a way for another player to participate in some reduced capacity. So, of course, Mario Galaxy 1 and 2 have the co-star mode that works pretty well for that. I believe the Lord of the Rings game that came out last year, Aragorn's Quest, is supposed to be... It is sort of geared towards a younger audience, and it has a co-op mode that's somewhat similar to that. So I think that might work as well. Zack and Wiki might be fun for a kid, you know?
Right.
It does have this somewhat cooperative sort of thing, and it's a very cute game. It's also a game where you can kind of talk to each other and figure out, and actually the kind of weird off-the-wall explanations a kid might have for how to solve a puzzle might actually be the way to do it in that game.
Right. Yeah.
Because it might be something that sort of defies logic, and so an adult might have a hard time arriving at it, whereas a kid might say, you know, why don't you just try this, and sure enough, that's what
works. Oh, the button's on the fucking bottom of the thing.
Yeah, so I think that might be a fun game to play with a kid as well. But yeah, there's a lot of examples of that on the Wii where it's a game that's it seems like it's primarily single-player mode, but there is this cooperative element. Well, you can switch between those as well, so you could let the kid drive the game while you help out and make it easier for the kid if he's having trouble with
it. Which helps with Super Mario Galaxy for sure.
Yeah, sure.
This isn't a Wii game, but if you have a GBA and the link cable, there's always Zelda, Wind Waker.
The Tingle Tuna. Yeah, Wind Waker. Yeah.
And you can actually be really freaking helpful if you're using the Tingle Tuner. I mean,
I've never used it. Is it fun?
If you get decent with it, you can basically rain bombs from the sky like Dado's about to do across the deserts of Libya.
That's pretty
awesome. You can become a real force of nature with that thing if you get good at it.
Well, let me say that if you can get a really good person doing second player trauma center, that's not good for your 5-year-old nephew.
No,
but
probably not.
Two players doing trauma center is one of the most impressive things you'll ever see in your life.
I don't want a 5-year-old performing surgery on me, thanks.
Unless you want that kid to grow up to be a doctor,
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, because the healing touch is something that they often teach in medical school.
You know, I'm getting like a million N64 games coming to my brain right now. that are not available on Virtual Console.
Yeah, if you have access to an N64, well, Jet Force Gemini has
Jet Force Gemini.
Yeah, that's Floyd.
You can play as Floyd.
Yeah, that's like the original co-star mode.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah.
Does everyone remember the heartbreaking way that Floyd dies at the end? So sad. He flies into the heart of the comet and screws his little eyes shut as he detonates himself in order to save the world.
Yes.
Wow. Yeah. It was a touching moment, and I think it was sort of like Aristine. I think we all... No, I'm kidding.
That game is difficult.
That game is hard.
Yeah, seeing the end of that is pretty tough, actually.
The last boss battle of that game really is a dramatic increase in difficulty.
He's called Mado or something, right?
Mizar,
yes.
Oh, Mizar. Yeah, Mizar. I got to him and could never beat him, I think.
That's kind of like a very common theme for that game.
All right, well, great question there from James in Louisville. And you can send your emails and questions, comments, ideas, whatever, to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. We do love hearing from our listeners. And again, if you enjoyed the PAX panel, either the recording or being there in person.
Or watching the stream when it was up.
That's right, watching a stream like Greg. You can send your thoughts on that, your feedback, your hope that we'll be invited back. You can send those actually to PAX at PAX_panels@paxsite.com. And we would appreciate that if you're inclined to do so. And of course you can rate and review us on iTunes. That's always awesome. You can interact with us in TalkBack on our forums over at NWR. We're on Facebook, facebook.com/RadioFreeNintendo. And I do want to pimp our sister podcast. Of course, by this time you probably heard the Famicast, which for now is at least going to be running on our feed. I don't know how often that's going to come out.
Yeah, that's still up for discussion, as I understand.
Right. I thought the first episode was wonderful, though. I'm really excited to hear those guys. I think they did a great job, and I'm very curious to hear more about, you know, the sort of gaming scene in Japan. So,
dude, those are our three Japanese correspondents, if you don't know. They recorded a podcast around the 3DS launch in that country.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to hearing a lot more from those guys. So we've got that. Of course, the newscast is out every week now. I know that they'll have some commentary about PAX as well. So if you want to hear more of the wrap-up. And then we have Radio Trivia. There's a new episode of that. I hope that not only the people in the audience at PAX, but also the people listening on the RFN subscription feed were exposed to Radio Trivia. Even the people who had never heard it before, it was their first exposure. I hope they really enjoyed that. I know the levels were a bit odd on the recording and it might have been a little confusing, but it actually is a lot easier to understand on the podcast, Radio Trivia Podcast Edition. And, we recently had an episode, it went up right before PAX, and I was on the most recent one with TYP, and the first game that we did, that I think a lot of people listening to the show will be familiar with is Bit Trip Runner, which has awesome music, really awesome soundtrack.
Rest in peace, Bit Trip series.
Yeah. I guess it's all done now. RIP Nate Dogg and Bit Trip and Leslie Nielsen. But, definitely check out Radio Trivia. I hope we've, whetted your appetite for that kind of stuff, because I think it's such a fun game. It's such a fun show to do. So definitely check that out as well. All right.
Wait.
Uh-oh.
Before we finish up, now, I realize this might be the last time that I ever get the chance to speak to Evan.
Oh, shit.
I think I've mentioned this on the show before, but since you're actually here, I can guarantee that you will actually hear this. I did want to say that there's a lot of reasons why I've ended up on the show and ended up editing it and why I'm spending more than 1,000 hours of my life on it today.
Yikes.
Evan is perhaps the single biggest one, because back when he started the podcast, I thought he was just so witty and engaging that it made me a big fan of the podcast, and that's how I ended up here. So, if anyone appreciates what I do for the site, they should appreciate what Evan did for me.
God.
You're going to make him cry.
I feel like you guys have done so much more with it than I ever did. I feel like I feel like a little peon being on here. So thank you. Thank you very much for letting me be back on, because this is bigger than anything Obi and I ever planned to do.
Yeah. And we, Evan was telling me earlier today that he actually edited several of the shows before, I guess, Carl took it over at some point. with the pirate radio thing, but Evan edited the first ever episode that had four people on it, which at the time was a big step.
It was a really big deal.
Yeah. It's now poor Greg does it every week and sometimes more than four. But yeah, Evan, thank you so much for being here, and I really appreciate you doing it. And I'm looking forward to playing a lot more video games with you over the next couple days. And I hope it's not another year and a half before we hear from you again. You know, we do have a big anniversary coming up soon.
Absolutely.
So we need to see what we can work out for that.
Yeah.
But it was really good to have you on again, and I hope everybody enjoyed it as well. And of course, thank you to James and John, and especially Greg, who is going to work extra hard this weekend, I think. So thanks guys very much for being here and for doing it, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Bye.
After that game, I do think they'll make another one. I'm kind of excited. I would love to see them go for sort of post Zelda 3.
Right.
Sort of like the, sorry.
I mean, don't refer to it as that.
I'm sorry.
You confuse me.
It's a shorthand because I never say Zelda 4 plus. I only say Zelda 1, 2, and 3, and 3 is Link to the Past, and I don't know where I got that from.
Yeah. There's a lot of people use it, especially in the British press, the magazines, you know, back then, because obviously it came out of Japan in 91, and it was, you know, the Japanese name, so that was just like the quick and dirty way of referring to it in English. And of course, you know, it was following on from a numbered Zelda game, whereas,
Zelda
of course,
2.
There were no numbered Zelda games after that.
Right.
I just have no sympathy for that.
I'm sorry.
They weren't going to call it Densetsu Kamigami.
Remember
no
when
Force.
I said I didn't want your pedantry in this episode, Evan?
Yeah.
Well, don't worry.
Okay,
I will
pedantry and Evan kind of go together.
Once you've seen the grandeur of it, it's kind of difficult.
It's massive, yeah.
It's that's right, because I showed it to John. I was going to throw it at somebody during the when they asked the question. I can't remember what the question was, but they were going to get it chucked at their head. And I pulled it out of my bag, and that was when John first saw it, and his eyes just locked on to how big it is.
Yeah, I mean, this is a, you know, that's what she said kind of gold mine, but I honestly thought I was like, I can't... It's like I couldn't.
It's marvelous, but it is big.
It does things that other devices I have already do.
Well, when I first got it, actually, I just couldn't get over how big it was. I mean, like, I just couldn't really grasp how big the damn thing was. But yeah, thank you, John. I couldn't understand the. Just getting used to having to play on the DSi XL was a lot to grasp immediately. But after a while, the XL became more... Jesus.
Graspable.
It was so big you could barely hold it in your hands, right, James?
It just felt so good, you know?